Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Borderline was the work of some avant-gardists. They were fascinated by Robeson as more or less an artistic object. He was the ideal of what I call the Beaux-Arts Negro. That is to say, he was a figure that artists tended to want to frame as the perfect image for black people. And he fit that ideal for so many avant-garde artists, particularly those who photographed him. Many of the photos don't even show his head. They show his tremendous muscular development, but they don't show much of his face. Many of them show him in a cramped space, so he's bent down, and it's almost as though there's a need to control all this muscular power. Robeson stands for perhaps black manhood, with all of the negative and positive implications that could have. In the 30s and 40s, there was fundamentally a need to make black people inferior. It was not only a need, it was almost like a law. Thou shalt not show a black person as a human being. The range of roles for black people were limited to buffoons, clowns, maids. They were always subservient characters, just above slaves.
Paul wanted to be a major actor. He was not in the art just for the art. He was in the art both in terms of what it did for him and what he could say with it.
Paul Robeson's films had very limited distribution in America. They were released as so-called ghetto features along with the black independent films, the Oscar Michaud films.
Oscar Michaud was this maverick filmmaker. He was the best, most prolific black independent filmmaker of his day. One thinks of Robeson maybe as a powerful screen presence, but subtlety and nuance was not there. So Robeson's acting achievements were separate from his presence on the screen. For one occasion, Robeson plays a villain, and he's a magnificent villain. A jackleg preacher just got out of jail, and he's robbing money from the offering plate. He's seducing women, and he's enormous in it. And that shows you what Robeson might have done as an actor if he was not locked into these public images. The primary concern when a black male appeared was, do we have to be afraid of this person? In many of these films, there was great satisfaction that his enormous appeal, his almost King Kong kind of strength, could be tamed and channeled, and he turned out to be civilized after all. A black actor was trapped between the expectations of white people on the one hand, and the needs and the desires of uplift of blacks on the other hand.
Did I want to learn how to kill? No, but they
But all kinds of interesting characterizations exist in between that.
These hands that I want to use to heal, to save life, to give life, turned into hands for killing. Summon the court.
The Emperor Jones is known as Robeson's masterpiece as the film actor.
I'm the only man in the world big enough to get me.
And you add a silver bullet, Mide?
Don't she die.
One of the problems of Robeson's film career is he's often playing magnificent or at least stunning or attractive or fascinating roles in stories that undercut the kind of heroism that he thought should reflect black people's lives.
Look here, white man. There's little stealing like you does, and there's big stealing like I did. But a little stealing, they get you in jail sooner or later. But a big stealing, they make you emperor and put you in the Hall of Fame when you croak.
The work that Robeson did in Britain is, in many ways, the saddest work of all. He went to Britain and he met the best people, and he thought he was among peers and friends. And yet, over and over again, these sometimes left-wing people, sometimes liberal people, they were into promoting colonialism.
Sambo of Monrovia, 5 months ago, you made yourself chief of the Orcadies. Didn't you know that no man can be chief in the river territories without my permission?
I knew, Lord.
It was the first feature film he made here in 1935, which he had high expectations of. I mean, he was led to believe by the producer, Alexander Calder, that the film would portray African life and culture in a positive way. Well, it didn't.
Warriors came from the old king's country. I've sent my spies at them. You rule 2 million people along the river. But there is only one man who will not run away when he sees the ostrich feathers of the old king's warriors.
And you are that one man?
I am the one man, Lord.
The character he played, Bosambo, I mean, it says it all.
Bosambo, will you serve my king faithfully?
Every time I've seen the beautiful face of your great king, my heart has filled with joy.
When have you seen his face?
Lord, little round pieces of silver.
Jomo Kenyatta plays a small role in this film, and he too thought it was wonderful while it was being made.
Lord Sandy, I am your servant.
It took them a long time to catch on to the fact that this film was praising British imperialism, uplifting the white man's burden, and making a travesty of black civilization in Africa.
Paul Robeson is being exploited in more ways than one. His sexuality, his singing, everything they exploit. I think Sanders of the River certainly spurred him on towards greater political awareness from the kind of criticisms that were made of the film. Robeson was particularly vilified by Marcus Garvey, damning his films and saying that these films are slanderous, and that he should not be making them.
One aspect of Dad's career is, of course, the financial aspect. There's no question that he got paid. One of the biggest single paydays he ever got was for doing the part of Joe in the movie Showboat. And he named a price that was so high he was sure it would be automatically turned down because he didn't want to do the movie. Too many stereotypes and whatnot. He wasn't really into that. Mother came over here, sat down with Universal, and got him to pay the fee. So then he had to do it.
As long as you and me, we sweat and strain, body all aching and racked with pain. Told that barge, lift that bale, you get a little drunk and you land in jail.
I get weary and sick of trying. I'm tired of living and scared of dying. But old man River, he just keeps rolling along.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, November 28, 2019. So I have been told, put that turkey leg down. Hope folks have not been gorging on chitlins, pie, any of the other nonsense that is common this time of year. If you are with family and friends, hopefully it has been a constructive exchange of views and you can be refreshed, rejuvenated for the new week. This is our book club. You can use some of that free time if you don't have to be on the plantation to do some reading. We are closing in. We have one more week left and we'll be all done with Dr. Gerald Horne's Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary. The segment that you heard at the beginning is from the documentary filmed Here I Stand which is also the same title of Robeson's autobiography. But just I thought that was really important to hear additional commentary about some of the films and even the ways that some of these whites who were supposedly his friends, his European homies, still practiced racism with the way that some of these films were put together. And I thought it was especially important just to get that reminder. They talk so much. It's taken as law, as though it is biblical lore, that black people are super smart and intelligent about racism. And just to hear again where black people being confused, being duped, being victimized, where they didn't really understand racism or even what it meant to be white. We'll go ahead and get started. We're in Chapter 7, Context of White Supremacy. This is Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary by Dr. Gerald Horn, audio segment number 1. Robeson's role as chairman of the Progressive Party was smeared similarly, particularly since he was so unsparing in his critique of the two major parties, Democrats and Republicans. Virtually any effort beyond a comforting conservatism and centrism were deemed to be subversive. Robeson castigated the powerful television network NBC for canceling a program on the Negro in politics on blatant political grounds, i.e., his scheduled presence. It was the artist who was deemed to be subversive by most in the U.S., as NBC was expected by a good deal of the populace to bar Robeson. Miss Robeson, in contrast, condemned the company's tyranny, indicative of how the once vibrant Popular Front had deteriorated. Was the culprit ousting him from the airwaves was Eleanor Roosevelt, widow of the late president, a woman with whom Robeson had collaborated in better days. Undeterred, Robeson was present at the creation of the National Negro Labor Council in Cincinnati, NNLC, a left-wing effort to marshal unionizing campaigns that was likewise maltreated by the U.S. authorities. The NNLC quickly became a pillar of support for Robeson, with future Detroit Mayor Coleman Young playing a pivotal role. Young was instrumental in establishing a United Freedom Fund designed to raise funds to attack Jim Crow and back the anti-colonial struggle. Robeson's twin causes. Young was the chief executive officer of the NNLC. John Pittman, a Negro communist columnist, encountered Robeson in 1951 and found the hair around his temples was graying, as he was now well past the half-century mark in age. A slight cough dogged him, too, a signal of deteriorating health to come. He had survived not only Peekskill and an attempted murder plot in St. Louis, but armed thugs, too, who had been dispatched in Memphis and Pittsburgh to dispense with him. Emoluments and enticements were dangled before those who would denounce him. So remunerative did they make the fad of repudiating Robeson that a smart character in the South was able to procure a new automobile and a sum of money for merely talking against him. Yet, like the stain in Macbeth, the prominence of Robeson could not be easily obliterated, for, as an editor put it, there is something of a Robeson in the brooding heart of every Negro. Moreover, de facto bribes in return for denouncing Robeson could lead to untoward consequences. The actor Canada Lee assailed him and was rewarded with a lead role in the early anti-apartheid epic Cry the Beloved Country, filmed on location. But Lee was so moved by the horror of South Africa that upon returning home he found it hard to keep quiet about this anti-communist ally of Washington. The intensified pressure created contributed to Lee expiring prematurely of a heart attack in May 1952. Robeson himself had little time to brood, involved as he was in shoring up various organizations, including the CAA, PP, NNLC, and the Communist Party, at a time when these were widely seen as an unholy quartet. The most controversial relationship he endured was his tie to the CPUSA, though he repeatedly denied formal membership. This was in addition to running his newspaper in Harlem, which had attracted a talented core of writers and artists, including Lorraine Hansberry, Alice Childress, and B. Richards. It was in 1952 when the latter two artists were joined by soon-to-be extolled actors Sidney Poitier, Harry Belafonte, and William Marshall, along with choreographer Donald McHale, in a Harlem benefit for freedom. Poitier was among those who endorsed the proposition that the richness of Negro culture has received no finer expression than in the career of Paul Robeson. What had brought these future Hollywood celebrities to Robeson's now tattered banner was his latest activist initiative, adding to his commitments with the CAA, CRC, PP, NNLC, etc. The Committee for the Negro in the Arts was a pet cause of Robeson, who knew more than most the formidable barriers that rested in the path of those not defined as white who sought to make a mark as an artist. As he put it in late 1951, finding jobs for colored actors, colored musicians, to see that the pictures and statues and the heads of colored painters and sculptures are sold, to see that the creations of Negro writers are made available. Special note was made of the field of dance, where Pearl Primus of Trinidad also had made a contribution to political radicalism. Where could there have come an Astaire, an Eleanor Powell, and James Barton without Negro hoofers, e.g., a Bill Robinson, a Burt Williams, an Eddie Rector, a Florence Mills? Where stems even Gershwin from the music of Negro America joined with the ancient Hebrew idiom, he replied. Yet billions of dollars had been earned and are being earned from their creation, and the Negro people have received almost nothing, amounting to an extension of slavery. And why were there not more Negroes on radio and television? The final answer is the South won't take it. Now, I had a program myself in the 40s, all set up by one of the biggest advertising agencies, he said, but one morning they said, we made some inquiries and the South just won't have it. Cancellation quickly followed. And then there was the sorry reality of the absence of the poor and working class from theaters, which he too sought to address by ensuring cut-rate fees for entrance to these groups. When we say that we are people's artists, said Robeson, we must mean that. I mean it very deeply. For artists are simply returning to the masses the very art the latter created. Bach and the chorale for which he was famed was an example. The people made it in the first place. Haydn, with his folk songs, and the people made it up in the first place. That is, the culture with which we deal with comes from the people. We have an obligation to take it back to the people. Such heartfelt words caused even those struggling to establish themselves, such as Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte, to flock to Robeson despite the cost. It was in 1978 that Poitier, then at the apex of his celebrity, recalled that Robeson used to meet with Belafonte and me, and we used to walk the streets of Harlem, just walk, and we would talk about things, about politics, about art, about race, about Africa, and I found him to be overwhelming in his knowledge, formidable in his commitment. He had phenomenal clarity, and we were kind of worshipers at his shrine, and he had an impact on every selection I've ever made as an actor. Still, it would be misleading to suggest that the spreading Red Scare hysteria left Robeson unaffected, even among African Americans. Such an impression would do little to explain his continuing disputes with the emerging heroes of Black America. First, there was the denunciation of him by Jackie Robinson. Then his fellow luminary from the baseball diamond, pitcher Don Newcomb, also with the Brooklyn Dodgers, confronted him in a Harlem tavern in the early 1950s and, it was thought, intended to attack him physically. On espying Robeson, the hulking hurler scowled as Robeson smiled, then spat out angrily, "I know all about you, Paul Robeson. They told me all about you." Robeson, who matched Newcomb pound for pound, though considerably older than the youthful athlete, sought to reason with him to no avail. The same success of a few of us does not change the picture for all of us, was the reminder Robeson uttered that fell on deaf ears. Unconvinced, Newcomb vociferously informed Robeson, "I'm joining the army to fight people like you." Robeson returned to Robeson too, sending him an open letter reminding him that if this baseball player wished to make a contribution to the cause of freedom, he too could be attacked from the right. Robeson pointed out that, in the recent record books, the All-American team of 1918 and the nationally picked team of 1917 have only 10 players. My name is omitted, airbrushed from the annals. "I can't get a passport," he said. "I can't get auditoriums to sing or act in. And I'm sometimes picketed by the American Legion conservative military veterans. I have some records on the market, but have difficulty getting shops to take them." Could not Robinson himself face such a dire fate if he deigned to carp militantly about Jim Crow? It is evident that the rebuke of him by those like Newcomb and Robinson wounded Robeson. This emerged when he was summoned by the House Un-American Activities Committee to be grilled. Robeson was quick to tell his inquisitors, "I know Jackie Robinson. I was one of the people to speak to Judge Landis, baseball commissioner, to see that Jackie Robinson had a chance to play baseball." This was in the early 1940s. "I addressed the combined owners of the sport in a successful administration of pressure, but the payback he received from Robinson and Newcomb was rebuke." Robeson advertised what had befallen him as a cautionary note instructing others inclined to walk in his footsteps. Hall owners, sponsors, and even audiences have been intimidated, he said in December 1952, "although I have recorded for nearly every major recording company and sold millions of records both here and abroad, these companies refuse to produce any new records for me." Then his own efforts to produce his recordings were hampered. Robeson did not add, perhaps because it would have undermined his case, that broad swaths of liberals turned away from him, unable to overcome antipathy to his defense of existing socialism. For example, the American Civil Liberties Union backed the denial of his passport. Still, what marked the early Red Scare was the resistance to it by those who could not easily forget Robeson's sacrifice on behalf of the anti-Jim Crow movement. At the annual confab of the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church in 1952, Robeson was the honored guest. Bishop William Walls asked the audience, "Everyone who is in favor of having Mr. Robeson's passport returned to him, stand on your feet." Instantaneously, 3,000 delegates stood as one, and two remained seated, one of whom was Edith Sampson, a frequent emissary abroad for the State Department. This was reflective of the reality that Negro churches, which filled a vacuum of leadership left when Negro Union leaders such as Ferdinand Smith were marginalized, continued to be one of Robeson's most effective means of reaching his public. When he was able to find a venue to perform, frequently it was in churches, though his outdoor concert in Chicago in July 1953 drew 15,000. "In this Midwestern metropolis," said Robeson, "no hall could be hired because of the terror mandating this change. 10,000 people," he said, "most of them Negro workers from the steel mills and packing plants, attended yet another concert." To put this in context, few figures during the Red Scare could attract as many adherents as Robeson did. Even today in the U.S., it is unusual for a public figure to routinely attract so many. Robeson's father and brother were both clerics, and he retained a special relationship with the church, leaving a deep imprint upon him. Robeson recalled how, as a boy, I saw my father reading Hebrew together with my brother Ben, and this early exposure to the Bible shaped his continuing multilingualism. He viewed his brother Ben, the pastor, fondly, terming him a gentle, gray-haired man of quiet dignity. He still adheres to the Republican Party, he added. Reciprocally, when Robeson sought picketers for demonstrations at the South African consulate in Manhattan in 1952, he instructed, "Get your church to join in observing 2 minutes of silence on Sunday, April 6, at noon." Still, even Robeson's victories during this era were clouded. Thus, his appearance before thousands, outdoors, in Chicago was prompted by the fact that a hall owner there had been threatened with repercussions, forcing the masses to brave the elements. Thus, by May 1954, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that Jim Crow was no longer the law of the land, though implementing this ruling unfolded slowly at best. However, the apparent easing of domestic apartheid combined with the pulverizing of dissidents like Robeson served to erode support for the now aging artist. The September 1953 edition of his periodical Freedom shrank in size dramatically, and by January 1955 it was suspended due to both technical and financial reasons, then quietly folded later that year. Chapter 8. Britain Beckons. 17 May 1954 marked a departure in the torturous journey of Africans in North America. For it was then that the High Court ruled that Jim Crow should no longer obtain. The Process Unleashed, which continues to unfold, also marked a departure for Robeson. It vindicated and validated his outspoken activism on this front. But it also eroded his base of support among particularly middle-class African Americans who were slated to benefit from this turn of events. Yet the retreat of Jim Crow also undercut the rigid conservatism that had undergirded the snatching of his passport and betrust his general marginalizing, which meant that he now would be free to travel abroad, notably to his beloved Britain, and replenish his severely diminished income. Yet the murder attempts, the rioting mobs targeting him, and the like all exacted a toll, contributing to a steep decline in his health and well-being that was to hamper his ability to take advantage of his dramatically changed circumstances. Robeson could have been a major beneficiary of these Copernican changes on the anti-racist front if he had been willing to cut his views to fit the prevailing fashion. But he would not. Weeks before May 1954, he demonstrated that he would not repudiate his remarks in Paris 1949 that caused so much consternation in Washington. "I ask again," he said defiantly, "shall Negro sharecroppers from Mississippi be sent to shoot down brown-skinned peasants in Vietnam to serve the interests of those who oppose Negro liberation at home and colonial freedom abroad?" An irate Robeson proclaimed that no one could miss the popular alarm and protest that flared up all over the country when Vice President Nixon recently suggested that American soldiers be sent to fight the Vietnamese. Ultimately, the NAACP answered a rousing yes to this query about combat in Indochina, deepening a cleavage among anti-Jim Crow advocates to the detriment of both sides. Robeson's voice, by way of contrast, was used to bombard U.S. prisoners of war in North Korea and China, as the High Court was ruling. Like anti-apartheid marchers in Johannesburg, the military authorities in Northern Asia provided those incarcerated a daily diet of his singing, which was meant to alienate them from their homeland, the U.S. Yet one visiting Negro journalist to these camps found that many of them have said to me in secrecy that they have nothing against Paul Robeson, or that they have a certain admiration for him. Neither postulate was crafted to win Robeson friends in the halls of power at home. How do you go along with Paul Robeson's ideas? Was the question put to Negro prisoners particularly. Do you think he's doing a good job for you and your people? The State Department did not find the request worthy of reply when Robeson's lawyer demanded the return of his passport so he could travel to China to speak on the centennial of the publication of the work of poet Walt Whitman. Of course, Robeson was honored and happy to accept your invitation, referring to his Chinese comrades. But the calcification of U.S. politics was in the process of crumbling, and not only because of the belated rendering of Jim Crow unconstitutional. For 1955 also delivered the exceptionally profound gathering of mostly African and Asian nations en route or already arrived at independence. Their rise placed a harsher spotlight on South African apartheid, which also served to discredit Jim Crow to the benefit of U.S. Negroes and Robeson alike. How I should have loved to be at Bandung, Robeson exhorted a meeting which he termed accurately a historic turning point in all world affairs. 2 years later, Robeson joined Dubois in Harlem, marking the second anniversary of Bandung and the rebirth of Ghana, speaking of the nation that surged to independence with Nkrumah and old CAA colleague at the helm, with both epical events being inextricably linked. Nevertheless, the depth of the problem faced by the left was exposed when Robeson felt compelled to reprimand one of two U.S. Negroes allowed in Congress. Adam Clayton Powell of Harlem had a merited reputation as a fierce fighter for civil rights at home, but, like so many others, he felt compelled to trim his sails when entering international waters, endorsing the predictates of U.S. foreign policy. The aggressive war policy of the Republican Party receives his support, Robeson charged. He wanted the congressman to debate with me in your pages, referring to the London Daily Herald, but Powell wisely declined. In short, Robeson continued to be featured in the foreign press while he was ignored or scorned in the press at home. Nevertheless, Robeson's voice continued to resonate abroad. This was not only because of his utilizing telephone lines to sing overseas via loudspeakers, but also because of his presence in film. His being embraced abroad and battered at home was also an aspect of the unavoidable fact that the Cold War had driven the U.S. even further to the right than its foreign allies, such as London. This included the remarkable documentary Song of the Rivers, helmed by Dutch filmmaker Joris Ivens, which celebrates workers' movements along six major rivers: the Volga, Mississippi, Ganges, Nile, Amazon, and Yangtze. The film poster was by Pablo Picasso. The score was by Dmitri Shostakovich, the lyrics by Berthold Brecht, with singing by Robeson. In a sense, this was come down for Robeson. He recalled his time in London and Hollywood. Then, he said, when I sang for films, there were elaborate studios with perfect acoustics, administered by the director, his assistant, the sound engineers, the conductor with his earphones, the orchestra in full sway, the small army of technicians. But now, at a metaphor for how the mighty had fallen, he was reduced to using the parsonage of his brother's Harlem church as a studio with his son, Paulie, an electrical engineer, quite expert in making recordings, at the controls. Millions in many lands saw this documentary, as it had commentary in Arabic, Japanese, Persian, Czech, Polish, English, Russian, Spanish, Chinese, French, and many other languages. But Robeson said in sorrow, "We here in America have been denied that opportunity, as American exceptionalism was exacted with brio. This riveting film was generally unavailable to U.S. audiences." Hence, Robeson was seen and heard abroad at a time when this was a major accomplishment at home. In 1957, a Londoner exulted that it was a great joy to hear your voice coming over so clearly at St. Pancras Town Hall this evening, facilitated by a new transatlantic cable that was laid quite recently, and it did not let us down. The audience, he added unnecessarily, was very moved. Thus, Robeson remained a pariah at home, but as the future Nobel laureate, the Chilean poet Pablo Neruda, informed him in 1955, I am speaking about you and your case in a great meeting for public freedom here in Santiago that will be attended by delegates of all Latin American countries. 15,000 people at least will be present, he said happily. I have remembered many times the promise you did to me long ago to sing for the Chilean people who admire and love you. We are prepared to pay your voyage and return, he concluded hopefully. Neruda was reflecting a hemispheric consensus in that a dominant image of Robeson emerged from Mexico when the painter Leopoldo Méndez, inspired by the wave of solidarity in favor of restitution of Robeson's passport, designed an engraving of the actor-singer with chains breaking and doves of peace with wings flapping. Fortunately for Robeson, with Bandung and anti-Jim Crow measures in the U.S. cracking the solidarity of reaction, an opening was created for his case to gain traction. What happened is that Robeson's consistent internationalism, his maniacal study of languages and cultures, was redeemed in a burst of poetic justice when a great wave of humanity demanded that his right to travel be restored. 10 days after the High Court ruling, a Paul Robeson meeting and concert was held in Johannesburg. Robeson's case became a cause célèbre in the land of apartheid. Walter Sisulu of the African National Congress spearheaded this effort, characterizing the artist as a fighter for peace and freedom at a forum that contended that he was systematically victimized for championing saying. It was also in May 1954 that a select group of Israeli intellectuals, writers, poets, artists, and musicians demanded that his passport be returned. It was during this time that a resident in a kibbutz tuned into a radio program of Israeli and Arabic music and American jazz when suddenly the voice of Paul materialized. This was a reflection of the special relationship that the Robesons enjoyed with the Jewish state, though like most of the left at that juncture, he was not on record displaying a similar solicitude for the Palestinians. There were personal reasons for this. The more I learn about the history of the Jewish people, said Miss Robeson in 1954, the prouder I am that a substantial portion of Jewish blood flows in my veins, adding quickly that this was a metaphor, that is, a very unscientific statement indicative of her Spanish Jewish heritage. Robeson had a close personal friendship with the famous Soviet Yiddish actor Solomon Mikowels and the Soviet poet Itzik Pfeffer, both of whom fell victim to Stalinist repression and, according to Robeson Jr., his father took sharp exception to what he saw as a recrudescence of anti-Semitism erupting in Russia. Still, at a time when Israeli influence was growing in the U.S., this too played a factor in generating support for return of Robeson's passport. Naturally, it was the British that were in the forefront of this movement, with the eminent Cambridge economist Maurice Dobb joining the affluent filmmaker Charles Chaplin in support of Robeson. How deeply am I moved by your recent message supporting the struggle now being waged to restore my right to a passport, was the message Robeson delivered to the British-born Hollywood star as he complimented your affirmation of life and beauty so poignantly portrayed in your classic Limelight. In London, Ivor Montague restored to history in detailing how, in the name of Magna Carta, by which already in the 13th century Englishmen won the right of unimpeded travel, this was now under assault in the Republic. Upon being deported to his native Scotland in the 1950s, the U.S. communist leader John Williamson immediately became a fount of support for Robeson. Yet he could not help but notice that other cases he worked on, for example, freedom for jailed communist leaders and other victims of repression, did not get the same broad support as the campaign for Paul. As with China, the idea was to invite Robeson overseas for a concert in this instance and then pressure the State Department to grant him a passport. This was the idea broached by Robeson to the Earl of Harewood. Leaders of the Ira Aldridge Society in London, which included the great tragedian's relatives, requested that he come to perform Othello, a request that was joined by the anti-colonial leader Fenner Brockway, Joseph Dijon, Haiti's ambassador, and Chief Obafemi Owolowo, premier of the western region of Nigeria. A film script on Aldridge, who was also developed, that opened with you unveiling the seat in the theater dedicated to Ira Aldridge. As was his tendency, Robeson linked his admiration of Aldridge to the latter's admiration of the constituent elements of the USSR, recollecting that the leading writer of Ukraine, Taras Shevchenko, was a dear friend of Ira Aldridge, who visited the Ukraine and Russia in the middle of the 19th century. Robeson walked in the great actor's footsteps, having had the privilege to visit Odessa, Kiev, and Kharkov. "I recall sitting at the quay at Odessa," he recalled later, "and looking over the beautiful waters. No wonder the immortal Pushkin loved this city," adding the father of the Russian language to this esteemed trio. And in working on some ancient music of the Byzantine period, one finds the way inevitably to the culture of ancient Kiev. To that end, a version of Othello filmed in the Soviet Union was also one of his ideas. In the spring of 1955, Robeson received a formal invitation to visit Britain, extended by sportsmen, theatrical workers, and scene technicians. He was touched by this gesture, calling it significant evidence of the united desire of the majority of the British people to have me continue my long personal association with them. This is very heartening. I look forward to the time when a similar united expression takes place in these United States to guarantee for all people the right to travel without arbitrary restrictions. The U.S. Communist Daily observed admiringly in 1955 that, because of popular request, the BBC has played a Robeson program daily for more than 10 years, while Scandinavian countries, where the artist had drawn tens of thousands a few years earlier, invited Robeson to become a citizen, as have a number of other countries. Unfortunately for Robeson, this wave of popularity did not necessarily translate into direct deposits into his bank account because of restrictions by the U.S. Treasury Department and the like. According to Cedric Belfrage, one of his most active supporters, this national affection for Robeson in Britain was best shown by the fact that although no new Robeson records have circulated here in a long time, the old ones are played over and over again on such top radio hours as the Morning Housewife's Choice. Unsurprising, since his name is a household word, being the perennial gift for which Britons are grateful to America. Worse for Washington was that, thousands of GIs, U.S. military men stationed here, hear him sing on the British radio for the first time. In Jamaica, to which Ferdinand Smith had been dispatched unceremoniously after years of Union leadership in the U.S., the communist informed the artist that the national radio station had just launched a Paul Robeson Day featuring about a dozen of your recordings. It was in 1957 in the former British colony of Canada, Vancouver, in this case, that Robeson supporters moved to organize yet another concert there by Robeson in support of his cause. Canadians were in for a treat, since it was in that year that he announced portentously, "I just recorded the other day what I think is some of the greatest singing I have done in the last 20 years." The New Statesman explained in 1955 that this British reaction was utterly predictable, particularly since in England there was no racial discrimination to narrow the scope of Paul's sympathy with left causes, at least not to the same degree as obtained in the U.S. Thus, at the Labour Party confab in Blackpool in 1956, there was considerable activity publicizing Robeson's cause. "It was beginning to snowball," said his friend Cedric Belfrage with pinpoint accuracy. "We need another tape," Robeson was told, as recordings of his speeches and songs were stunningly effective in galvanizing support for his case. Whereas he was banned from commercial TV in his homeland, efforts were then being made to place him in the same medium in England. "Actually," said Belfrage, "he was informed we could get a Robeson program shown on TV in most European countries, which would be a very big thing, not least in revealing a rift with nations thought to be the closest allies of the U.S. There was a National Paul Robeson Committee, which in 1956 held a major conference in Manchester. Members of Parliament, union leaders, and religious figures were among the 150 attending this December gathering. Months later, 27 parliamentarians demanded that Robeson be allowed to visit London. London was befuddled by the persecution of Robeson. "Were I an American and frightened of Paul Robeson's political opinions," said Earl Baldwin of Bewdley, "I would not hinder his political opinions, I would not hinder his departure, and should be only too glad to get rid of him. In fact, he demanded irritably, send him to us. We should be honored by the presence of such a fine artist." But it was not just London that was baffled by the vitriolic response to Robeson among the U.S. authorities. As his popularity abroad continued soaring, a visitor to a bookstore in Bucharest in 1955 watched as a man bought a reproduction of a Soviet painting, Song of Peace, depicting Robeson at Peekskill, while in Budapest, a student proudly displayed his excellent etching of Robeson singing. In Krakow, a lad started singing My Curly-Headed Baby in Polish in an uncanny voice emulating Robeson's voice and manner. Robeson had been catapulted into legendary status in the first place because of his popularity abroad and, unsurprisingly, when the time came to rescue him from the clutches of his antagonists, the international community weighed in emphatically, creating domestic ripples hard to ignore, particularly among religious figures. By 1955, 300 clerics, befitting a man whose father and brother were pastors from Baltimore and Washington, demanded that his passport be returned. they may have been influenced by the crusading of the Civil Rights Congress, CRC, then, like CAA, in its death throes, but with its leader, Patterson, still capable of effectively placing the passport denial in the context of Robeson being a vector for global revulsion at the horror of Jim Crow and colonialism. It was true that other institutions were emerging to fill the vacuum left by the impending demise of the CRC, those tied to Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in the first place. However, these new groupings did not have the international ties of the CRC, nor the global reach of the CAA, which amounted to a net loss for African Americans and their allies. Feeling the heat, within months, the House Un-American Activities Committee beckoned him to appear for a theatrical berating. Robeson was unrepentant, participating in what was reported as a shouting, table-thumping, and gavel-banging hearing. It was a dramatic thing, said Robeson's attorney, Leonard Budin, a very traumatic confrontation, which did not leave Robeson, a very warm, intense, serious person, though prone to anger when pushed, unaffected. A surprised reporter later asked Robeson about the contention by HUAC's counsel, Richard Arings, who claimed, "You spat in his face each time before you answered his queries, and he wanted to crash a chair over your head. Your comment?" "I have sacrificed literally hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars, for what I believe in," was his direct message to the committee. "I have read a lot of Marx," he said, "a regimen that began not in Russia. I started to study that in England." Indeed, he stressed, as he so often did, "all my political education, strange to say, came in England. That is, my Marxist education was also influenced by the Labour Party." His hairline now receding, but his voice booming and advancing as usual, he told the legislators, "I knew all the members of the Labour Party, so you cannot blame that on the Russians. You will have to blame my Marxist education on the English Labour Party." Then, twisting the knife further, he added with mock whining, "They have just invited me to come to London next week to sing to 140,000 miners up in Yorkshire. Do you think that you could let me go?" He balked at disavowing his friendship with Ben Davis, who he termed one of my dearest friends, one of the finest Americans you can imagine, a great man. But he also balked when asked if he was a member of the U.S. Communist Party, registered under the name John Thomas. Robeson's critics were disgusted with his words, particularly his contention that the Republic was built on slavery, which caused the U.S. to seem the hypocrite when assailing the socialist camp. The Milwaukee Journal epitomized the outlook of his belittlers when they reviled a tragedy of intellect and talent, a tragedy of his race, a tragedy of America, all encapsulated in the tragedy of Paul Robeson. Robeson's bravura performance before HUAC did not win him many adherents in official Washington. Budin, his lawyer, found it to be quite unusual when higher-ups in the State Department handled the passport dispute, indicative of how seriously it was taken. After the blow-up at HUAC, Robeson conceded, "I have been doing a great deal of thinking, in other words, about taking my case to the Supreme Court, but now was reluctant." "Supreme Court action is expensive," he said, "and therefore financially impossible for me to undertake. given his straitened circumstance. Practically the whole burden falls on me, he groaned, and I am not in a position to assume these burdens any longer. With Jim Crow easing, Washington strained to ensure that Robeson and the radical left could not take advantage by making sure their time was expended heavily in courtrooms and legislative chambers, converting them into firefighters focused on dousing flames at the firehouse. Months after the anti-Jim Crow ruling in the High Court, the CAA was in federal court seeking to halt liquidation. Demanded by the authorities was all of their correspondence with Mandela's African National Congress. Demanded was the CAA register with the Fearsome Subversive Activities Control Board, which meant providing a license for escalating harassment, for once information was provided to this agency, it was often used for enhanced persecution. Washington well knew that despite the propaganda about the Soviet Union, one of the closest international relationships that involved Robeson was his tie to anti-apartheid forces. Robeson well knew that a central reason for denying him a passport was his anti-colonial, anti-Jim Crow activism via the CAA and CRC. This bare-knuckled legal brawling was also costly, expenses that Robeson and his cohorts could hardly afford. A symbol of the financial sacrifice forced on Robeson because of his politics arose when Patterson spoke with Paul about participating in the meeting against intervention in Guatemala. He agreed to do so, asking only if it was possible to pay an honorarium of $25 to Paul's accompanist. The U.S. overthrow of this Central America regime on spurious grounds of communist infiltration was a mordant symbol of the Red Scare, as was Robeson's protest of this violation. Yet the point here is that an artist who once commanded a six-figure income was now reduced to performing in his homeland for nominal fees. For it was not only solidarity events with Guatemala where Robeson was compelled to perform for peanuts, but in other venues too that in past days would have delivered adequate compensation. Contemporaneously, the New Statesman confirmed that in 1948 alone, when he made an estimated 500 free appearances in support of the Progressive Party, he was giving away the equivalent of $750,000 at the box office to help win votes for Henry Wallace. In sum, Robeson was not without weapons of the genocide petition filed at the United Nations. This prompted Senator John Bricker of Ohio, with substantial domestic backing, to propose constitutional amendments restricting the scope of international treaties, e.g. the Genocide Treaty, on the U.S., yet another attempt to forge American exceptionalism, but also a signal of grave apprehension about trends overseas. The restrictions on his traveling north of the border were eased, allowing Robeson to inform dear friends in Britain in May 1956 that last February I sang in Massey Hall in Toronto and for the metal miners in Sudbury, Ontario, finding immense warmth of these audiences, meaning a Trans-Canada tour was planned. A startled Ottawa then decided to bar me from entering Canada and joined their U.S. counterpart in attempting to prevent me from making a living, but the impression left in Canada could not be erased or downplayed. Because he remained one of the better-known public figures in the Republic and definitely the most radical of this small circle, Robeson was even more in the crosshairs of Washington's political snipers as the overall political atmosphere thawed. This was recognized by Alice Childress, one of the coterie of artists. She was a noted writer who worshipped him. Your encouragement and faith in my ability to produce is in great measure responsible for her recent explosion of productivity. Things will change for you, she insisted, since times are changing. Yet, because your stand has been a stronger and bigger one, you will be fought the longest. He was fought the longest in part because he was among the most steadfast. After the death of Joseph Stalin, 1953, the Soviet intervention in Hungary in 1956, and the Stalin devaluation in Moscow that same year as the Communist Party in the USSR renounced and condemned their longtime leader, confusion erupted in the ranks of the U.S. communists, with some calling for a break with the Soviet Union. This was occurring as another brush fire was lit in the wake of the rise of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and halting steps toward desegregation, with some communists arguing for a ditching of the party's view that Negroes constituted a nation meriting self-determination. In these party wars, Robeson, as to be expected, stood stoutly alongside Davis and Patterson, who leaned toward overthrowing the Negro nation thesis and refusing to break with Moscow. This is a moment when steadiness is especially necessary in left ranks, counseled CP Patriarch William Z. Foster, who too was part of the Davis-Patterson camp. Undoubtedly, he continued, there has been much confusion and vacillations caused by the Stalin affair and especially the tragedy in Hungary, signifying that Robeson's counsel, too, was desirable on such fraught matters. Foster announced that he would be glad to have a chat with you about all this. The leader of the U.S. communists also sought to confer with Robeson on the Negro nation thesis, telling him the American Negro question is theoretically a very complicated one. The FBI thought that Robeson merited added scrutiny given his background, intelligence, and nationalistic sympathy, which suggested he may well be one of the real leaders or possibly the real leader behind the Foster-Davis faction of the CP. Because of former trips to the Soviet Union and to Europe, he may be the one who is actually giving the line, i.e., Robeson was deemed to be much more dangerous to the security of this country than even communist leaders. Robeson placed the blame squarely for the unrest in Hungary on the shoulders of the ultra-right. His interpretation of these events was placed prominently in the pages of the Baltimore Afro-American. He got more space in our press, said George Murphy of the family that controlled this important organ, than the Dean of Canterbury got in most of the daily papers of the U.S. That, to me, is important. That it was. Robeson's voice continued to carry weight among U.S. Negroes, and it was hard for it to be otherwise as long as Jim Crow reigned. It was in late 1956 that a mostly Hungarian-American assemblage responded by picketing his speech at the annual gathering of the National Council of American-Soviet Friendship. Early arrivals were showered with eggs, tomatoes, and sticks, as typically for the era, police watched idly. There were virulent taunts of murderer and priest killer and communist traitors, while Robeson particularly was targeted with a well-aimed bottle filled with ammonia. In a sign of progress, unlike Peekskill, no racist imprecations were reported. Foster may have heard what Robeson told an Australian journalist a few years later when, after describing himself as an ardent advocate of socialism, he called the Budapest Revolt fascist. A socialist planet would surely rise without too much violence, maybe, he opined. While rehashing his controversial remarks in 1949, he said bluntly that if the U.S. fought the USSR, he would be found on the side of Russia. This attack on the Hungarian revolt carried a cost for Robeson. His staunchest supporter in London, Cedric Belfrage, who was also close to the radical left in the U.S., warned him about taking a position of all-out defense of the Soviet troops in Hungary, since this intervention has demoralized, discouraged, and confused British progressive forces much more gravely than any other of the USSR's controversial actions. In Britain, for example, the CP is split down the middle, a convulsion that engendered mass resignations. British support for the USSR over Hungary outside the CP is virtually zero. He fretted about the impact on the National Paul Robeson Committee, which had been organized on a non-political basis, but now this particular issue is so all-pervading that if you are known to take an uncompromising position on it, we would be unlikely to be able to head off the effects. There are now some 150 organizations participating in our campaign to get you to this country to sing. Now jeopardized, he thought. Robeson ignored this counsel, though. Contrary to Belfrage, it had no appreciable impact on his British support. Indeed, months after Belfrage's dire warning, he was told a worldwide action on Robeson's birthday was brewing. Chaplin would be in it, of course, and so would Sean O'Casey, Sartre, Picasso, Hermann Hesse, Ulanova, Shostakovich, Laxness, and why not Graham Greene, Louis Armstrong, Arthur Miller, Jussi Björling, along with Ingrid Bergman, Gina Lola Brigida, and the brightest stars in the film firmament. Thus, by the mid-1950s, Robeson had managed to survive the sturdiest blows of his opponents and was dishing out a few of his own. The liberalizing climate had facilitated an anti-Jim Crow ruling and slightly improved relations with Moscow, all of which helped to propel a reinvigorated attempt to restore his passport, thereby allowing him to benefit from the continuing adoration of audiences abroad.
Context of white supremacy. First audio segment. Put that turkey leg down. So we will pick up the paragraph in my book. It is 156. But as in a deadly chess match, the U.S. authorities responded. That's the first sentence we're picking up at. It's basically the last full paragraph on page 156 of the book that I have. With that, the cows, no so-called holidays, system of white supremacy. If you have questions, comments, thoughts to share, finish chewing, then dial 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Hopefully, you all have had a constructive day. If you are not on the plantation, we can settle in, read, think constructively about Mr. Robeson. One thing I did this week, I did do a little cooking today. Whew.
pretty tasty. But I also went to the University of Washington Library. I've been there many, many times, broadcasted from there and all that. Went there yesterday. I got a book, but I also was able to get some of the newspaper archives from the 1950s on Paul Robeson. It was pretty wild to just kind of be able to go through the book and have pretty much access to most of the footnotes that are referenced in the book to try to find if there are any cool or interesting things that I wanted to research further. But just adding that, I'll read some of the news clipping that I picked up. But it is amazing if you have the ability to go to university, college, libraries. Just always great to be reminded. I've done that before when we've read materials. But just wow, to be in an environment where they have so many books and newspapers from 100 years ago or longer, from all over the world, certainly all over the so-called country, and books, magazines, journals, students' papers, you know, it's abundant. I think the University of Washington at Seattle is a repository of sorts. So they have lots and lots. They have hardback copy of Urugu, multiple copies, if my memory is correct, as well as the ISIS papers. They are not ignorant about white supremacy racism. But yeah, reading, woo, way more important than watching television. I am glad book club on this here day. If you have questions, comments, things that stood out, ooh-wee, anti-blackness, things that stood out from this portion of the reading, *61, if you would like to chime in. All the folks who are with us with a hand up line should be open. Proceed. See, we have retired firefighter while folks are getting their thoughts together. If you had thoughts, questions that stood out from the first portion.
Significant thing that I always notice is the reference to the Bandung conference. Just about any non-white person who has had some sincerity in their attempts to counter the global system of racism, white supremacy, either was there or at least mentioned the Bandung conference. The first time I heard about it was actually from a speech that Minister Malcolm, I can't remember which one it was, a ballot or bullet or one of his more popular speeches where he mentioned about the Bandung conference. And he was like literally bragging about the idea that they wouldn't let any white person come to the Bandung conference. But I think it was centered around the word decolonizing areas where non-white people resided primarily. And Mr. Robeson mentions about the Bandung conference. I could be wrong, but I think that there was a non-white representative from this part of the world that went there. I'm not exactly sure on who it was, whether it was Adam Clayton Powell or I'm trying to think. I can't think of his name, but he can pass for this black male can pass for a white person also. I just can't think of his name right now. that may have been. But I know it was one representative from this part of the world that was attended that conference. And that's the most significant thing that I heard in the first reading. And I'll hold it there and let someone else talk. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter, who has done quite a bit of the narrating for this text. Some of it we played, and some of it that didn't even get played. And he was still in laboring, doing the work. Much obliged, sir. Other folks, *61, if you have questions, comments, thoughts you would like to add, I'll keep an eye on the switchboard. In fact, I will see if I can nab one of the, there we go. Alrighty. So this is from the summer of 1956 in the New York Times. One of the footnotes from this week's June 12, 1956. House group favors citing Paul Robeson, and it's got a photograph of him from the testifying in front of the House. Can you imagine that today? They call you in, you have to go and talk, you know, in front of who's in Congress right now. You might have to go and chat with some of these folks. They want to ask you question or three, grill you about, you know, 10, 20, 30 things. I mean, whoa. Where have you been going? Particularly, now imagine having to go and you have to talk to Congress and the FBI has been tracking you for the last, let's see, this is, so they've been tracking you for at least 20 years, maybe longer, but a good 20 years. The FBI has been following you, like, daily, wherever you go. Probably listening to your phone calls, you know, communications, if you write a letter, email, whatever, all that. Text messages, they got it. They've been 20 years of your life, they've been hanging out. While you're in college, the whole nine, they're checking out, And then they're upset. You're talking about racism, white supremacy, or using whatever the lingo of today, Black Lives Matter, whatever. And so, yeah, you got to come. We want you up here on the Hill. We got a few words we want to, you know, talk to you about. Upset about some of what you've been talking about. Get down here today. J. Edgar Hoover, FBI, the IRS. I don't even think we got to that part yet. The IRS is after you. And you got to go talk to them repeatedly. In fact, I forgot. They didn't even just do it one time. They call you in repeatedly because they're upset about what you're saying. That's what I said again about why words are so important. That's why Mr. Fuller harps on that all the time. That's why Mr. Edward Williams, so many people emphasize words are critical. Mr. Robeson didn't have an army. Mr. Robeson is not running around with rifles and machetes and talking about kill white people. There's got rumors that he's dating white women and doing plays about dating white women and all of these white people that he's friends with all over the world. Just talking about racism. Black people aren't being treated well. Black people aren't being treated well anywhere in the world. We should be talking about this everywhere I go. We should be talking about this, how bad black people are treated. That is enough to get you called in front of Congress? And then allegedly being a so-called communist? Get out of here. Anyway, the New York Times report says, contempt of Congress proceedings were begun against Paul Robeson today at as the upshot of a shouting, table thumping and gavel banging hearing at the Capitol. The contempt action was voted by a subcommittee. Oh yeah, wait a minute. It goes on to, I had to make several copies. So let's pull up the other one here. Okay. Second one continued on page 25. Boom. House unit votes to cite Robeson. The House Committee on Un-American Activities, after the singer had clashed repeatedly with the chairman, Representative Francis E. Walter, Democrat of Pennsylvania. Mr. Walter said the action was based on Mr. Robeson's general conduct at the hearing, personal attacks on the committee, and the smear of Senator James Eastland, Democrat of Mississippi. I'll pause here. Now, if you are a student of history, then that name should stand out. James Eastland, my goodness. When they talk about massive resistance and the history of Mississippi and white people who are responsible for the death of Medgar Evers, Emmett Till, probably a lot of other black people in the state of Mississippi, James Eastland's name is at the top of the list. And in fact, Minister Malcolm X and I, that would be at least one more thing we agree on. He talked about Senator James Eastland quite a bit. I don't have to pick out one speech. He mentioned him all the time because he was always talking about the Negroes are causing problems and talking about supporting racism, white supremacy, massive resistance, the exact campaign that I mentioned. So the audacity to say that a part of the problem with Mr. Robeson is that he smeared. I think that might even be in the word guy. He smeared Senator James Eastland of Mississippi. I think James Eastland is one of the what they call Dixiecrats. Another word for racist white supremacists. But these are the Democrats who are supposed to be the liberals and the good white people. And forget that. These niggas are a problem. We got to be explicit about that. In the 19th, lots of them. Virginia, Mississippi, all the areas that are big time Trump places now. Anyway, continuing, this is the New York Times report. On different grounds, the subcommittee also moved to bring a contempt citation against Clark Foreman, director of the Emergency Civil Liberties Committee of New York and president of the Southern Conference for Human Welfare. Similar action was threatened against a third witness, Dr. Otto Nathan, associate professor of economics at New York University and executor of the estate of Albert Einstein, the scientist. Mr. Foreman and Dr. Nathan faced contempt citations for their refusal to surrender their passports in response to a subcommittee subpoena. Both volunteered to produce their passports for examination at the hearing without losing possession, but Mr. Walter ruled their citation did not satisfy the subpoenas. The group is investigating what Mr. Walter has called the use of passports in the furtherance of the international communist conspiracy. He ordered a session of the full committee for tomorrow morning to carry forward the contempt proceedings against all three witnesses. The full committee is expected to ask the House of Representatives to cite them for contempt of Congress. If voted by the House, the citations voted would go to the Justice Department for presentation to a grand jury and possible prosecution. Conviction carries maximum penalties of 1 year in jail and a $1,000 fine on each count. Mr. Robeson brought a stormy morning session to a sudden close by raising his resonant bass voice and shouting, pitch and asserting, you are the non-patriots and you are the un-Americans and you ought to be ashamed of yourselves. Representative Walter banged his gavel and declared the hearing adjourned. I have stood just about as much of this as I can, he said. He immediately conferred with three other members present, and they unanimously voted the contempt action. Before the final blow-up, Mr. Robeson angrily denounced the committee. Here it is again. Angrily denounced the committee, Senator Eastland, and others in response to questions about his activities and his travels to the Soviet Union, to Soviet Russia. Dr. Nathan, who won a new passport June 7 after a 2.5-year court battle, contended that the subcommittee's demand constituted unreasonable and unlawful seizure. I will stop there. Most of this, the rest of this, does not deal with Mr. Robeson directly, but this is from the New York Times. They have Mr. Robeson's picture, and this was on the front page in the New York Times. I forgot to add, this was not buried. This was not on the back. This was on the front page. So can you imagine that? You get called to the, or can you imagine any black person gets called to Congress right now? We're upset about what you have to say about Russia we're upset about what you have to say about racism. We're upset that you're out here talking about how black people are mistreated here, and you are a so-called communist. We think you might have had something to do with the Russian election interference, and we're calling you to testify right now. And this is on the front page of the New York Times. Can you imagine that? Like, whoa. Paul Robeson. Notes that I took from this week. And that's what I mean. That's what I mean. Like when I said before that I did not think it was written correctly. It was not well written. The section where Dr. Horn talked about the car accident where his vehicle was sabotaged. If you're having this much pressure being brought to bear on you, then the language that we use to talk about incidents that happened to you should also reflect that. Moving forward, let's see. So notes that I took. It was the artist who was deemed to be subversive by most in the U.S. as NBC was expected. Oh, this is when they talk about him being kicked off. And Eleanor Roosevelt, this was so important. Miss Robeson, in contrast, condemned the company's tyranny, indicative of how the once vibrant popular front had deteriorated. Was the culprit ousting him from the airwaves? Was Eleanor Roosevelt, widow of the late president, a woman with whom Robeson had collaborated in better days? That is so common, and in my view, why it is so dangerous at any time in the system of racism, because there are a lot of incidents of this, of white people who were friendly to a black person at one point, and then they changed their mind and decided that, forget this nigga stuff. I'm just going to practice racism, stick with what's been working out with me well so far. This is 12 Years a Slave. Solomon Northup, he was friends with some white people, and worst combination in the universe, they got together drinking, and then there you go. 12 years later, thank God. We got some more. Tom Watson, he's down in Georgia. This is a white man around the turn of the century, the fusion movement that they talk about in North Carolina, Georgia area. Yeah, white people, the same rubbish that you hear here. Communists, socialists, white people and black people, we're going to get together and down with the establishment. Yeah, working class, the proletariat. Let's get together. Marx knows what he's talking about. All that rubbish. And he said, forget that. These niggas, this. Back to the, let's just stick to, why break it? Why break something? If it's not broke, why fix it? Stick with the white supremacy. Lots of examples. Lots of them. The hippies, 1960s, lots of them. We can go on and on. What happened to all that with Occupy Wall Street? Remember that? The 1%? Remember all that? They were camped out? Continuing. This for me is on 137. John Pittman, a Negro columnist, encountered Robeson in 1951 and found his hair around his temples were graying, and he was now well past half century. Slight cough dogged him. This is what I mean. This is the result of J. Edgar Hoover, COINTELPRO, white people who are paid, probably well paid, pension, benefits, all of that, very well paid and well trained. Not any haphazard thing, just get in there and do whatever you want. Well trained and motivated to watch you, and your family and friends, whoever you're talking to, wherever you travel around the world or around the block, to watch you with hostility for 25 years or 30 years. That is the result. Total deterioration in health. You can see it. Mind, body, spirit. Wow. That is the result of white supremacy racism. Let's see. Slight cough dogged him. Signal of deteriorating health. He had survived not only Peekskill and an attempted murder plot in St. Louis, but armed thugs who had been dispatched in Memphis and Pittsburgh to dispense with him. Emoluments and enticements were dangled before those who would denounce him. So remunerative did they make the fad of repudiating Robeson that a smart character in the South was able to procure a new automobile and a sum of money for merely talking against him. All of that is a direct quote. That is extraordinary. That's when I probably should have taken a moment to go in the catacombs and dig out that footnote, because all that most of what I just said is a direct quote. But I mean, wow. Where they can do all of this to attack you. And I mean, that's a direct correlation. We can spy on you. We can pay white people, train them to sit around and spy on you, investigate you and all of that. And then we can also turn around and play back black people. Hey, say that's the coon of the year. Matter of fact, we'll give you an extra piece of cornbread, coon of the decade. Man, give it some feeling. Give it some authenticity. Really call him some extra. He's a extra Sambo. He's an extra coon. He's a full coon. That's the one I heard the other day. He's a full coon. Make up some new ones. We'll give you an extra $10,000. That's what they said. He bought a new vehicle. Imagine that. We're talking 1950s. Talk bad against this black person. Get enough money, you'll get your new vehicle in the 1950s. Imagine what that would be today.
That is what domination looks like. We got so many where that's how you end up at 50, looking like you're about to die. You got white people on this side, armed white soldiers who just sit around the clock and spy on you. And then you got other black people. I thought we were friends. Maybe you were, but that is the system of white supremacy where, bam, now you're a coon that's on the front page of the newspaper. I get called to kind of like, man, and I'm broke. I don't even have any money. That also would be a phenomenal illustration, the life and times of Paul Robeson. He is not a prisoner, but I mean, wow, greater confinement. This is exactly why the logic is right here in the life and times of Paul Robeson. Why Mr. Fuller says greater confinement. No, he is not a prisoner, technically. But man, it does sound like he's a prisoner. You get invited, you get asked, the hired, come work here, we'll pay you that. Nah. They talked about white people tried to say, nah. It's not allowed. No, nigga, you can't have it, and that's that. Can I travel up? Nope. If I get such and such people to speak, nope. Did I commit a crime? Have I been charged with a greater confinement? Continuing. Man, I could give the roll call, but I am kind of, it would take a lot of extra work with my hands and fingers. I would need a little help. Man, oh man, the cowbell roll call, when he gives a name of a lot of victims of white supremacy who were doing attempted counter-racist work, but wow. In addition to running his newspaper in Harlem, which had attracted a talented core of writers and artists, including Lorraine Hansberry. I'm skipping that. Well, I can do it this way. Lorraine Hansberry, cowbell that I know. Alice Childress, Bea Richards. It was 1952 when the latter two artists were joined by soon-to-be extolled actors Sidney Poitier, Harry Belafonte. Cowbell. Wow-wee, the influence of white supremacy racism. I know Lorraine Hansberry, she's passed away. She wrote Raisin in the Sun, which featured Sidney Poitier and P. Diddy at points. I know she has got to be tired because Minister Malcolm X talked about her as well, about being married to a white man. She got upset and confronted him about that. She got tired about being called out about that. But, I mean, it's incorrect behavior, and Harry Belafonte, Sidney Poitier, they're victims. They've been sexually sued, but I mean, that is so prominent. Next. This is from me on 139. Why there are not more Negroes on radio and television? The final answer is the South won't take it. I had a program myself in the 40s, all set up by one of the biggest advertising agencies, he said. But one morning they said, we made some inquiries and the South just won't take it, just won't have it. Cancellation quickly followed. That is rubbish, in my view. That is consistent. We have a term made up by that caller in Florida, racial focal pointing, just trying to make it seem as though the racism, white supremacy is just Senator Eastland. It's just the Dixiecrats. It's just the white people in Georgia and Mississippi. You know, they just won't allow a Negro on television. That's just said about Medgar Evers. But, you know, the white people elsewhere, you know, they are. Come on. All the white people in Chicago, we just read Sundown Towns. So you're talking about all the white people in Anna, Illinois, ain't no niggas allowed. They would have been all right with Paul Robeson being on television. Next. I do think it's important. I just mentioned them cowbell, but I do think it's important when he said Sidney Poitier and Harry Belafonte flocked to Robeson despite the cost. Despite the cost, the system of white supremacy racists can make it costly just to have communication with another non-white person. It was in 1978 that Poitier, then at the apex of his celebrity, recalled that Robeson used to meet with Belafonte and me, and we used to walk the streets of Harlem, just walk, and we would talk about things, and I found him to be overwhelming. And he talked about the impact that that had on his career. That's extraordinary. But I mean, wow. It was to have it be that it was a cost to be in contact with this black person. Like, I'm putting myself at risk. Let's see. Oh, my God. Speaking of risk, anti-blackness, man. He said, this is another one, Nan Madge. He says, fellow luminary from the baseball diamond. This is after Jackie Robinson has talked bad about, went to Congress to talk bad about them. On top of that, people just don't talk bad about you. They get invited to like the halls of Congress to talk about what a coon and a dummy you are. Then it continues. He says, baseball pitcher Don Newcomb, victim of racism, confronted him in a Harlem tavern in the early 1950s. It was thought and intended to attack him physically. Can you imagine that happen? You're over 40 years old and you have a professional athlete who you have never met. You don't owe him any money. You didn't wreck his car. You didn't talk bad about his mom, his parents, family members, wife, children, none of that. Y'all never met. He just doesn't agree with your view on racism and probably has been told things by white people about you that may or may not be true, probably false. But you get confronted by a professional athlete who says, oh, yeah, I know all about you, and I'm ready to fight. Let's go, Coon. What? Because he says, and they're about the same size, boom, boom, boom. Robeson uttered that it fell on deaf ears. He tried to reason with him, it says. Robeson uttered that it fell on deaf ears. Unconvinced, Newcomb vociferously informed Robeson, I'm joining the army to fight people like you. Confusion is lethal. Again, there's so many examples, I feel like, just in this book alone, in terms of who is most confused about white supremacy, racism. Not that I'm even saying Mr. Robeson is super informed, or myself. I've pointed out repeatedly many times it's been Mr. Robeson who's been confused. That's how the audio started today. But wow, I'm ready to fight another black person in a tavern who I've never met just because I don't agree with what he said on racism and what white people have said about this person. And telling him that I'm going to join the army to fight people like you. I'm going to join the army and probably fight, train to fight and kill, or more likely be allowed to use toilets and make toilets and dump latrines, because that's what they'd be. Matter of fact, this would be about the time you'd be going to Korea. You'd be with Mr. Fuller. You'd be doing nonsense with Mr. Fuller. I'm going to go hang out with Mr. Fuller as we try not to get killed or kill other non-white people in Korea because I'm upset with black people like, whew. Continuing, let's see. Chapter 8. We got another Walt Whitman sighting. We've talked about him so many times on the program. This is in chapter 8, page 144. Mr. Robeson gets invited to China to speak on the centennial of the publication of work of poet Walt Whitman, The Power of White Supremacy, where you can be invited on the other side of the planet in reverence of a white supremacist. Walt Whitman, I say nigger all the time because of people like Walt Whitman. This guy talked explicitly. We should not, oh man, ending slavery was terrible. Look at these niggers have run wild. That's the exact verbiage that he used. He may have said niggers or nigger, but I mean, it's in writing. N-I-G-G-E-R, very explicit. We talked about this with Breaking Bad and the reverence for Walt Whitman in the culture and Breaking Bad and all of this, but he gets invited around the world to come and praise Walt Whitman, the white man. Let's see. This is another, the language, because this verbiage was used consistently in the portion of the reading we read this week. He says, this is Dr. Horn says, the calcification of U.S. politics, I don't even know what that means, was in the process of crumbling. And not only because of the belated rendering of Jim Crow unconstitutional, that's where I don't think the term Jim Crow should be used if we're talking about the system of white supremacy. That's not clear. And if we're saying system of white supremacy, if we replace it, now it makes it more accurate that the problem that Paul Robeson was dealing with in the 1950s is the exact same problem that we're talking about now under different rubric of Black Lives Matter. I think that starts to bring greater clarity to what we are addressing with language. And stop picking up white people's terms. See, it's Jim Crow one minute, it's colonialism the next minute. Stop using whatever terms white people come up with to describe them practicing terrorism against black people. Let's see. When he talked about bad dung, I guess I'll try to be as quick as I can on this. This is a direct quote from Robeson. How I should have loved to be at bad dung. Robeson exhorted a meeting which he termed accurately. That's important. That's the only reason I'm reading this, because that word, accurately, a historic turning point in all world affairs. I do not think that that is an accurate statement. There's nothing about that event reflecting now over 60 years later that I can say, oh yeah, people can look at that event and say everything changed from that point. I do not think that that is true at all. And anybody who is listening live, archive, you should make sure you speak up on that. If I was going to give a quick example, I can look at 9/11 and say, oh yeah, I can see how, wow, so many things, laws, wars, deaths, lots of things changed as a result of that right there. Presidential administrations, lots of things that I can look at. Oh yeah. Glot dynamics of the system of white supremacy. Oh yeah. Right there. Literally. About an hour. From 9/11 to 9/12. Totally different day. From that conference, I wouldn't even know where to begin with a list of, oh yeah, laws started changing, this started happening. Now, I mean, now you can say, maybe, all of the things that happened under the rubric of the so-called civil rights movement and anti-colonialism, but that stuff had already been going on. I don't think all of that happened. Everything subsequent of 1955, like Little Rock and the March on Washington, like countries, so-called countries getting independence on the continent, I don't think that's because of Ban Dung. Even hearing the line about white people not being allowed is odd to me in a system of white supremacy. If white people really, I wasn't there, so I don't know, but if white people had really wanted to go, and particularly in the 1950s, I mean, hey, they could have said, how about this? You niggas are not going to have the conference. How about that? And who would have stopped them? 1950s now, I mean, hey, we just dropped a nuclear bomb, so I mean, hey, conference is not going to be had, and that's that. As I said, that is one just because the word accurate was used, and I just don't think so. I've heard quite a few folks talk about that event. Important, yes, but world-changing? Next, hyperbole. I did think it was kind of wild if you're a black, given the stature that Paul Robeson is known, he's being invited to China and all over the world. He's gone to Ireland and all these places. He lived in Europe and gone to the Soviet Union, gone to the continent. People in South America are, you know, prominent people, not just nobodies. And black people are not hearing him because of the power of white supremacy. Same power that they have today to say, yesterday you saw Colin Kaepernick play football, now you don't. Yesterday you heard Paul Robeson on the radio, or you saw him at the theaters, now you don't. They have that same, that is power of system of white supremacy for black troops to not hear him in the States. They have to go around the world and, oh wow, Paul Robeson, never heard this fellow before. Wow, that's crazy. Let's see. It says again, Jim Crow, this is on page 152, Dr. Horn, he says, Jim Crow was easing. I would have a problem if someone said that in 2020, that Jim Crow, or if they substitute white privilege, white supremacy, racism, any other wording, verbiage people want to use. White privilege is any vernacular people want to substitute. I would say that that is not accurate. What are you pointing to? If you want to look specifically at this context, he's writing in the night. This is Dr. King hasn't even been assassinated. Jim Crow is easing. Medgar Evers hasn't even been assassinated yet. Jim Crow is easing. The Freedom Rides haven't even happened yet. Jim Crow is easing. Like, what are you talking about? Massive resistance hasn't. Senator James Eastland hasn't even got started yet. Like, you think he's got all Paul Robeson's nerves from where we are at this book around the mid-1950s? Wait till he gets to about the mid-1960s, till he really gets rolling. James Meredith tries to integrate Old Miss and those type of things, where he really has to get amped out about what's going on in his state. Like, What are you talking about? That's what I mean about just the language that we use is not accurate. This is not a fiction book. If we were reading Tar Baby or something like that, then okay, you could have all the hyperbole you want. You can exaggerate. You have a lot more license, creative fiction. You have a lot greater license, right, to say things, to not be as tied to fact. This is nonfiction, and specifically, if we're addressing the system of white supremacy racism, there is no need for nonsense. Jim Crow is not easing. The system of white supremacy is rolling strong. Next. Oh, yeah, they thought they let him go to Canada, and then they don't. I thought it was great. This is another example. Some of his white friends who had been cool, they're communists in the 30s. They had been, oh, yeah, the niggers down in Alabama, the Scottsboro boys, that's so messed up. Let's rally and get a defense fund for them, which they did. Let's make this a cause celeb. We'll talk about this all over the world, which they did. Now we get to the 1950s, and it's, whoa, whoa, whoa. Some communists arguing for ditching of the party's view that Negroes constitution a nation meriting self-determination. Like, eh. All right, we've had enough of talking about these Negroes. It's wasting time. It's Dr. King fell and all the rest of it. We got other things to talk about. It's 1950, 1955. We got other things to talk about. We don't talk about this Emmett Till stuff anymore. That is so consistent with white people. That's why I said it doesn't matter, even if they, you know, come in for a day or for a year or two and seem like they are really. I am not a racist. I finally found a good white person, and they have been doing everything for the last year, the last 5 years. Mm-hmm. I've never met such a person, but even if such a person did exist, this is what I've seen. Eventually, I'm good. I'm good. Just practice racism. I make it tough. Anything else? I want to make sure I get in. Things keep getting said about the ultra-right. I have no idea what that is. System of racism, white supremacy. You see a lot of that same confusion with verbiage today. Last one I'll get in. The metaphors again. Page 156. Thus, by the mid-1950s, Robeson had managed to survive the sturdiest blows of his opponents, meaning racists, I presume, and was dishing out a few of his own. I have not heard one single blow. I have not heard anything where, oh, man, Paul Robeson, he got him, boy. He, you know, set up a trap. He raised some funds, and boy, he got that James Eastland, man. He got his passport revoked, or he got, you know, his house foreclosed. I didn't hear anything. Not one where he stuck it to them or did this. He delivered to, even if it wasn't that he caused white people directly some problems. I haven't even heard anything where it's, oh, wow, he really did something and helped out a ton of black people. And just, wow, things were exponentially better for like a whole slew of black people, like super improvement quality of life for like the next 50 years because of what he did. He like changed laws that, oh, man, they got houses and, you know, these their great-grandchildren still have these houses because I haven't heard anything like that. Certainly nothing to the magnitude of what white people are doing to him, like trying to kill him and all this electroshock therapy that they talked about and taking his money, taking his pet, nothing on that level, not even close. That's what I mean. Like racism gets talked about that way all the time as though it's sometimes white people on top, sometimes black. No. That's not what we have here at all. We have white power, substantially more power than non-white people. That's what this entire book, we're almost at the end. That's all I've heard. It can't be that much in the last portion. We've read over 75% of it. That's what this book is. It's a total indictment of white terrorism against Paul Rudd. That's what they said. Deterioration in his health, deterioration in his marriage, gray hair. He's gained all this weight in the hospital. That is white supremacy racism. We tried to kill him. We took all his money. Greater confinement. That's what I read. I didn't read anything about, oh, and Paul Robeson, he stuck it to them this time. Boy, he got them this time. I didn't hear any of that. Maybe I missed it. Didn't read clear or didn't narrate because I did narrate some of it. The person who dialed in 0067. Did you have comments, questions you wanted to get in?
Greetings this evening. This is Rob.
Rob, no longer in Wisconsin.
San Diego.
Yes, sir.
Hey, greetings. So I am, I haven't been connected to the book series that much, but I have listened in just tidbits and tidpieces, and were laying out about the system of white supremacy and how it can take you through just the lowest levels of the human experience, depleted funds, weight gain, bad health, like whatever it is, that's where I am right now. And what the cow's been in existence for 10 years, man, that's just great. Just great effort in countering this massive system that we're under. I really don't have a lot to share at this point, but my life is drastically better since I've been in San Diego, California, and not Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And thank you for taking my call.
Much obliged. That is, you know, talk about stating the obvious. Water is wet. San Diego is better than Wisconsin. Yes. I'm ecstatic to hear it. Ecstatic. And yes, maybe we'll get more updates on the compensatory call-in or down the road. But ecstatic to hear it. Change of venue is good sometimes. That's why that restriction, when Mr. Fuller says greater confinement, Mr. Robeson could travel within the states, presumably, but we're just not going to let you leave. You can't go to Canada, can't go there. Maybe we let you go on Monday, but then we don't let you go on Tuesday. As for anywhere, Europe, forget about it. Greater confinement. Sometimes they make it even smaller, you know. They don't let you go to San Diego, so you can't be down here. They do that sometimes, too, in a variety of ways. If you have additional comments, make a note. We will get to the second audio. We only have one more session, and we'll be done. New book, I guess, people, you can be thinking of that, although that is not something we're chatting about today. You can be thinking of that, but we will resume with the audio. We are in Chapter 8, Black Britons, on page 156 for the book that I have. This is Mr. Paul Robeson, or this is Dr. Gerald Horns, Paul Robeson, The Artist as Revolutionary, The Cows audio segment number 2. But as in a deadly chess match, the U.S. authorities responded forcefully. The denial of his passport was upheld by a federal court in 1955 with his reluctance to file an affidavit attesting that he was not a member of the U.S. Communist Party being at issue. As the cameras rolled outside the courtroom, Robeson, perhaps thinking of his yeoman duty during the anti-fascist war, resorted to Shakespeare in his deep and rolling cadences. I have done the state some service, and they know it. I pray you, in your letters, when you shall these unlucky deeds relate, speak of me as I am nothing extenuate, nor set down aught in malice. Topping off this impromptu performance was his singing verses from Waterboy, along with several lines of a song in Russian. The latter was akin to poking a stick into a hornet's nest. He lost his court appeal on passport restoration in mid-1956. This occurred despite a brief filed in his behalf signed by Dubois, among other dignitaries. Recalled was the visit to India by J. Saunders Redding, a liberal Negro intellectual allowed a passport, who, while there, was asked repeatedly, "Why has your government denied a passport to Mr. Paul Robeson?" After returning from Germany, Austria, Italy, and France, Congressman Adam Clayton Powell Jr. said, "In every country I was asked the same questions, all about Paul Robeson." A Negro journal in Los Angeles asked mischievously if Robeson would receive a passport if he vowed not to enlist global support for African Americans. And then, unleashed upon him, was the feared Internal Revenue Service, the tax gatherers, who requested an audit of his finances, a process that in the worst case could lead to a prison term. They have been trying for years to send Paul to prison, but haven't been able to find any grounds for doing so, said Ms. Robeson. Income tax, which is the usual method they use, is impossible in our case because for years our lawyer, who is an expert on income tax, has handled all our money. The IRS seemed to take notable umbrage at the awarding of the Stalin Peace Prize to Robeson, which had brought him $25,000 in 1953. Still, because of his charitable donations and his lax administration of his finances, Robeson's adjusted gross income in 1955 was a paltry $10,685.04. Still an uptick from a few years earlier. By 1956, this figure was $15,299.19, but had dipped again to $9,685.52 the next year. However, by 1958, as his right to travel was restored, his income had leaped to $39,095.11, with the increase largely attributable to British sources, since in early 1957, his law firm presented him with a bill for services of $4,382.81, mostly for efforts to regain his passport. This increased income arrived not a moment too soon. Washington was not inclined to unfurl the white flag of surrender simply because Robeson was being applauded abroad. This Robeson well knew, and in case he had suffered memory lapse, there to refresh his recollection was Davis, still languishing in a jail cell after his 1949 conviction in federal court, fundamentally on the specious charge of simply being a communist. The heralding of Robeson in prisons was akin to an invitation by the authorities to place the artist among his ardent fans. Davis had lost none of my old starry-eyed admiration for you after more than a quarter century of personal friendship, poking his comrade with the point that there are legendary stories of you in every prison in America. The Negro prisoners, in their own way, speak your name in hallowed tones. Bulging with respect, even as he remained trapped in an iron cage, Davis told his friend that these prisoners' knowledge of you is their passport to pride in their people. But this burst of good news was accompanied by concern for Robeson's health, which had deteriorated sharply, a result of irrepressible travel and concomitant loss of sleep, an inadequate diet, tension delivered by murderous plots, etc. By late 1955, George Crockett, Davis's attorney and a future congressman representing Black Detroit, was happy to hear that Robeson was on the mend and should be your usual hearty self within a few more weeks. This was not to be. Robeson was on a downward slide physically that would restrain his travel and his income and lead to his death in early 1976. Robeson had sought to escape traveling to Washington to testify before HUAC earlier in 1956, a request roundly rejected. HUAC demanded that an independent medical examination occur. They looked askance at the report from his urologist, who had had Robeson as a patient since he endured major surgery in October 1955, which left him confined to his Harlem residence for months, the result of a recurrent infection in the urinary tract that was quite disabling and necessitated further surgery. Dr. V. McKinley Wiles emphasized that stress had left him in a weakened condition, which was catnip for HUAC, who thought that enhancing his stress was a neat idea. The press reported that Robeson had a major emergency stomach operation. Further surgery did occur in November 1955, according to his physician at Harlem's Sydenham Hospital, for a prostatic hypertrophy with acute urinary retention with massive hematuria along with cardiac enlargement. There was left ventricular hypertrophy and myocardial damage, all of which was extremely serious for a man not yet 60 years of age. Travel, advised Dr. Aaron Wells, would affect unfavorably the status of his heart, which was akin to an invitation for HUAC to subpoena him forthwith. Robeson was in bad shape. Worsening his health was his extreme susceptibility to heavy colds. "Paul has been so very ill," said his spouse as his HUAC appearance was unfolding, "that I have decided that he should not attempt any concerts at all, for the operation was more of a shock than we had thought." Helping to sense his mortality was his attendance in March 1955 at the funeral of his once friend, now sparring partner, Walter White of the NAACP. He had ridden the wave of anti-communism, becoming a confidant to presidents in the process, but did not seem to realize how the continued viability of those on the left, like Robeson, bolstered his high-level access. Nonetheless, Robeson had access to medicine that money could hardly buy. As the impact of the second surgery loomed, Pablo Neruda told his fellow writer, Howard Fast, "If you see Paul Robeson, tell him, please, his song was given to the charcoal miners who only 2 days ago introduced by myself." As ever, some U.S. artists found it easier to speak up against Robeson's persecution when artists of the stature of Neruda did so. Still, Lorraine Hansberry probably required no prompting, as she had received her first break as a young writer when she was hired by Robeson to work for Freedom. Citing the credo of Cyrano de Bergerac, whose stark words she put in Robeson's voice, she posed questioningly, "What would you have me do? Eat a toad for breakfast every morning? Wear out my belly groveling in the dust? No, thank you." A writer in the Negro press imitated her vigor by asking why should a passport be revoked because of an anti-colonial position. Hansberry, who went on to become a prize-winning playwright on Broadway by dint of her work, A Raisin in the Sun, was courageous to speak up on Robeson's behalf, for contemporaneously her peers were being hounded for similar relationships. The FBI reported that the poet and playwright, once known as Leroy Jones, then Amiri Baraka, was sufficiently bold to attend Robeson lectures, while this agency sought to have poet Sarah Wright fired from her job because she was supposedly an admirer of Robeson. Naturally, all writers did not agree, and this list included Carl Rowan, the Negro who was to serve as U.S. ambassador to Finland, responding to his writing for the flagship publication of the now affluent John H. Johnson's growing media empire headquartered in Chicago. He observed provocatively, not inaccurately, that most white persons in this country definitely regard Paul Robeson as an enemy of the United States. His interlocutor conceded that if he were to interview Robeson in a mass media platform, I think NBC, the television network, would probably be boycotted and picketed and maybe shot at, confirming at once both the venomous hostility to the artist and why he was being treated like a non-person. But it was left to Rowan to confirm the verity that global pressure was to assuage a declining internal situation. A member of the Diet in Japan looked at the situation in this country and said, "Well, if these Americans feel superior to Negroes who've lived there and fought and died for their country, what must they think of us?" After the release of Robeson's well-received memoir, Kenzo Nishikawa of Japan, who had read the translation, told the artist that he was now winning a greater reputation than ever. With enthusiasm, he told Robeson, "You have shown you are superior to the white in mind and body, both in ability and strength. That's our pride and the highest and glory of our colored races." Rowan's suggestion that Robeson had betrayed the Negro was not a notion accepted universally. On the contrary, said Frederick Seabrook, the Negro and America had betrayed Paul Robeson due to fear. Rest assured, he asserted, the State Department, the press, and even our very own professional race hustlers will never succeed in dethroning Paul Robeson in the hearts of the masses of Negroes. Nevertheless, confirming further the breadth of the effort to marginalize Robeson was not only a scholar's contention that press coverage of him in the so-called newspaper of record, the New York Times, declined sharply during the 1950 to 58 era, the period when he was under de facto house arrest. What was also striking was the contention of Paul Robeson Jr. that most newsreel and film footage of his father had vanished, and that most of newsreel footage which is available has had the soundtrack erased from it. But this same scholar who exposed why this information blockade had begun to crumble. It was in 1957 that the launching of Sputnik by Moscow shook the confidence of Washington, leading to agonizing reprisals, including whether it made sense to maltreat so atrociously the vast human capital that reclined in the African-American community, thereby curbing market potential and ill-preparing a sizable sector of the labor force to propel a complex economy and compete, for example, in rocket science. It was also in 1957 that an attempt to desegregate a high school in Little Rock, Arkansas, led to riots by the working class and middle class defined as white, bringing a black eye to the U.S. globally and hampering its ability to charge Moscow with human rights violations. A missionary in South Africa then reported that hundreds of Africans and non-whites asked him about Little Rock and Robeson. In fact, said Dr. A. Chester Clark, executive secretary of the Missionary Department of the African Methodist Episcopal Denomination, the most frequently discussed topics among South African non-whites was the conjoined matters of Robeson and Little Rock. Miss Robeson, who by now had established an enviable reputation as a journalist, had a direct pipeline to a leader of the desegregation fracas. Daisy Bates was head of the statewide NAACP and also, she said, had the pleasure of hearing from Robeson, who sent her a lovely family photo. "The next time I am in New York," she enthused, "it would indeed be an honor if I could visit you and meet the family." Miss Robeson wrote about Bates' desperate struggle in global periodicals, telling her that "my colleagues from all over the world were simply enthralled by the Little Rock affair, and I was a reference point for their clarification. I was the one Negro available," she boasted with some accuracy, "who didn't bite her tongue and called a spade a spade." Despite their tireless efforts, the U.S. authorities, as the political climate shifted, were unable to block the Robesons altogether, from the emergent anti-Jim Crow forces, notably in Dixie. Earlier, Robeson had offered his wholehearted support in the aftermath of yet another example of racist outrage when Emmett Till, an African-American teenager from Chicago, was slain by ultra-right racists in Mississippi in 1955. The outrageous acquittal of lynchers stirred his conscience, moving him to offer all that I have, my art, my strength, my devotion, to our common cause. The reaction to this slaying detonated an explosion of protest from the Atlantic to the Pacific. Even Ralph Bunche, now safely ensconced in the highest reaches of the United Nations and distancing himself furiously from his former left-wing background, found it possible to contact the Robesons after years of hiatus. Ruth, his spouse, and I thank you and Essie most warmly for the inscribed copy of your book, adding on UN stationery, no doubt there will be a family row as to which of us gets first crack at it. The premier boxer, Archie Moore, also an African-American, contacted Robeson from Sao Paulo, where he had just won a bout with the champion light heavyweight boxer of Brazil, who happens to be colored. But the details of this pummeling were not the purpose of his message. For me, he proclaimed, you have played a great part in my life, notably since I have followed you many years. To be sure, he added quickly, I am not a hero worshiper by a long shot, but there are men I admire, and you are one of the few. Inspired by the artist, he admitted, I believe I was put on earth to do something greater than just be a champion athlete. My greatest desire is to meet you in person, so please call collect. That Moore was able to travel while Robeson was not was hardly lost on Miss Robeson, though she chose to focus on the musician Louis Armstrong and those like him. Their jazz tours abroad, sponsored by the government, were the reverse side of the coin in the State Department fight against Paul Robeson, denying him his passport because when he goes abroad, he criticizes the treatment of Negroes in the United States. Ergo, Robeson must be kept at home, must be immobilized, must be silenced. Her own activism attracted the attention of congressional bloodhounds as she was summoned for questioning by Senator Joseph McCarthy himself. Noah Griffin, NAACP leader in normally liberal San Francisco, was effusive in thanking Robeson for the inspiration which you gave my son during a recent concert there. He brought home an autographed program of your recent concert at Third Baptist Church. Actually, by August 1957, Robeson had appeared 5 times in the Golden State in recent months, performing up before 10,000 in the city by the Bay and Los Angeles. Negro churches had become a kind of sanctuary for his performances, offering, as they did, attractive terms to the artist. Terms for church concerts, advised Miss Robeson, are usually 60-40 of the net. That is 60% to him and 40% to the church after expenses have been deducted, with a guarantee of a minimum of $500 to cover the time and work. Robeson's peregrinations had revealed a trend that was to shape U.S. politics for decades to come. Writing from their now permanent address at Harlem's Jumel Terrace, Miss Robeson observed that her spouse spends much of his time on the West Coast, where the political and artistic climate is far superior to that of the East Coast. The FBI, too, had noticed this trend. Robeson, it was said, was not just performing in California, but was seeking to consolidate the left forces in the CP, there, as evidenced by his being very close to Pettus Perry, preeminent Negro communist. To that end, Robeson, it was said, plans to move to Los Angeles to live. Robeson, said the FBI, was becoming increasingly effective out on the West Coast among the Negroes and especially among some of the Negro clergymen. He had approached the pastor of one of the more important Negro churches in Los Angeles and convinced the pastor to let him sing to his congregation. Robeson explained that the pastor could take up a collection for his church and the entire collection he could keep because he, Robeson, did not want any of it. All he wanted was to sing and sing and sing. The pastor agreed and collected over $1,100. This news spread quickly from pastor to pastor, leading to a cascade of invitations from other churches. In all these engagements, it was said with bitterness, Robeson gets across one or more points in behalf of communism and Russian viewpoints. An emboldened Robeson was now planning to take a trip into Mexico with the same approach. Slowly, it was dawning that, perhaps, allowing Robeson a passport so he could resume residence in London was the least bad option. This was the backdrop to yet another Robeson visit to Washington, this time arriving on 29 May 1957 at the State Department at 9:35 a.m. and staying until 3:05 p.m. in another attempt to regain his passport. He declined, per usual, to answer if he was a member of the U.S. Communist Party, but immediately responded when asked where he would go if his passport was to be restored. Moscow? No, said Robeson. I would go straight to London to do concerts, first under the sponsorship of most of the leading composers of Great Britain, such as Dr. Vaughan Williams, the Dean of English Composers, the greatest living composer there, and also Mr. Benjamin Britten. But yes, he would also visit Prague, where Mozart had all his operas performed and where Haydn lived. Telling his questioners what they already knew, he seemed to take delight in discussing how, on Sunday night, I sang into London, where many of the English artists appeared in a concert at St. Pancras, and over the telephone I was broadcast into the hall and sang about 20 minutes of a concert and was able to accompany a Welsh choir. He reminded those who may have forgotten that I sort of lived in Wales at different times and was very close to the Welsh people, even singing in their own language. Robeson also seemed to take pleasure in exhibiting that he was not the only one under pressure. He pointed out that of late in his judicial opinions, Justice William O. Douglas of the High Court observed that it was of importance that the anti-Jim Crow decision be taken because of world opinion, because of world opinion, he repeated. He linked himself to this trend by underlining that just recently he was at one of the major demonstrations on civil rights in Washington, tens of thousands amassing, and many Negroes came to me and said, "Paul, we might not be on these steps of the Lincoln Memorial today, but for certain of the things you have stood by and fought for your people." In other words, Robeson was part of this global movement that was forcing a recalculation by Washington that was to lead to his regaining his passport and his seeking to exert even more global pressure. "I know many of the men of Ghana," he said, speaking of the nation in the vanguard of African independence. "Many members of the government were in college in London when I was there. I know many of them. Robeson's questioners also probably knew that he paid close attention to Little Rock participating in a forum that suggested it represented the symptoms of the evils of racism. He took note of the vote at the United Nations as early as 1952 denouncing apartheid, then advised that leaders of the fight against racism in America should carry the struggle again to the UN, as had been done by himself and the CRC a few years earlier. Like Dubois, he seemed to become more militant, not less, as he grew older, as when he informed an inquiring New Zealand reporter subsequently that as for Little Rock, I would have asked thousands of Negroes from all over the United States to go there armed, adding triumphantly, I'm sure that nothing would have happened. Robeson's passport seizure and the crucifixion of him had begun at a time when a good deal of the world was colonized. But by 1957, a new world was awakening, particularly with the independence of Ghana, an epical event that Robeson, not so subtly, brought to the attention of his interrogators. Surveillance of him would have revealed a point he did not note, that is, his growing closeness to populous India, which, given this nation's historic ties to London and ongoing political relationship with Moscow, which persists in the 21st century, ensured that New Delhi would weigh in on his behalf. After all, he had known Prime Minister Nehru since the 1930s and had grown close to his daughter Indira, a future prime minister in her own right. In early 1958, Robeson had heard from an Indian official at the UN that he had an urgent letter from Indira asking that you send a greeting to the people of India via tape recording, a request that was satisfied promptly. Yes, Robeson told the State Department with pride, I happen to know many of the people in India. Thank you so much for the beautiful silver dish, Miss Robeson gushed in early 1958. We are delighted that you received the book and tape. More to the point, Paul is deeply moved, as we all are, by the fact that you in India have formed a birthday committee and that your father wrote a marvelous letter in support of it. Officialdom in Washington knew that the Prime Minister in early 1958 hailed Robeson as this great humanist to mark his 60th birthday in April 1958. The State Department took note when Nehru called his celebration more than a tribute to a great individual, since such occasions are tribute to that cause for which Mr. Paul Robeson has stood and suffered. Plans were afoot to organize concerts and theater and drama in big cities on this hallowed occasion. Even the New York Times temporarily eased the embargo on news about Robeson to inform its many readers of the important fact that Robeson is a hero to most Indian intellectuals. With such surging support abroad, it became easier for domestic forces to support Robeson. The leading Negro newspaper, the Pittsburgh Courier, highlighted the fact of British support for Robeson's cause. His wife was aware of this inextricable tie between the domestic and the global. She was deeply grateful for Nehru's avid backing of Robeson's cause. Thus, the major press here in New York City was forced to give it coverage, and this gave just the needed impetus for our friends in Actors' Equity. Actors' Equity, the union, had a general meeting, recounted Miss Robeson, to offer a resolution. In the spring of 1958, and Ossie Davis, a Negro actor friend of ours, presented a resolution appealing for a limited passport for Paul. Ralph Bellamy, president of Equity, spoke against it to small effect since it passed by a vote of 111-75. Robeson, she said, is greatly heartened by this. Punctuating this victory, in 1958, there were birthday celebrations for Robeson in all of India's key cities, with Nehru's daughter serving as chair of the events. Finally, the dam broke. We are literally packing our bags and will be off the moment we get the passport, was the harried message of Miss Robeson in 1958, as the High Court ruled that their friend and comrade, Rockwell Kent, could not be denied the right to travel, a ruling which encompassed the now delighted couple. In anticipation, invitations had been flooding into their home from Britain. "It was extraordinary," she said. "They have been telephoning almost every hour." There was great excitement about a wonderfully well-sponsored engagement for Paul to appear in the Palladium. Then there would be an event on Easter Sunday in their special nationwide television show. The latter is one of the most important events in their entertainment world, carrying a whopping fee and an amazing list of sponsors. In eager expectancy, they have already put up huge advertisements all over London. Context of white supremacy. That will do it for this week's section. We are all done. We will pick up next week at the beginning of chapter 9, and that is it. We'll be pushing off brand new book for the cows. Said this book is not that long. That was one of the reasons that we went ahead to read this text. One, I didn't know that much about Paul Robeson, so I'm always down to learn, but this is not a super long book. One more session and we'll be able to start on something new before we get to 2020. Number again is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. if we have any folks that we missed totally, like you didn't get to share at all and think you might have a comment, question, something that you want to get in, the Bandung Conference from 1955, I said that I do not think that that is a world-changing event, I guess depending on how you define what such an event would be, but at least in my view, I do not think that that would qualify. If we have any folks who would like to respond to that, feel free as well. But if you have questions, thoughts on the text, retired firefighter Rob in Wisconsin should be with us. I'll look out for folks. If we missed you totally, I'll make sure we nab you before we conclude the broadcast.
Can I be heard?
Retired firefighter, yes, sir.
Not at all. Speaking about the Bandung Conference, no significance at all. As I was stating, I first heard about it from Minister Malcolm X literally bragging about the idea. And he mentioned, I think he said something to the fact of they meaning the non-white people wouldn't let white people come to the Bandung Conference. And at that point in time, when I first heard it, you know, it was kind of like a quote unquote macho type of report, as opposed to more of less of reality that I have an understanding of today. The problem is still here. Even something that's amongst my thoughts, apparently I have to always give an inventory of what I'm saying and doing, because the problem is still here also. And so I haven't came up with the answer in itself. With the last report, Don Newcomb, Major League Hall of Famer, I think he was the first black male pitcher in the major leagues. Satchel Paige came, he was older, and I think he came right after him. But nevertheless, with their idea in mind, I think that same thing would happen today, unfortunately, based on what I have studied and observed, let's say with the idea in mind. I can't think of that that racist white male who is presently in the National Football League right now that terrorized the black male athlete while he was at all parties, was at the Miami Dolphins.
Richie Incognito.
Yes. He would be defended, unfortunately, by non-white black males. The behavior, the attitude, the mindset is still potentially can take place. It's similar to what happened back during that time. I thought it was interesting that the idea in mind of the tax situation and how it was reported that Mrs. Robeson kind of like had, I think it was her that had it basically up to the level to whereas the races did not use that particular practice in order to destroy Mr. Robeson. The system of racist white supremacy and its practitioners have used that weapon on some of the most well-known non-white victims of racist white supremacy, such as Joe Lewis. And James Cleveland Owens, better known as Jesse Owens, they literally destroyed their financial lives through the income tax. Joe Lewis, as a matter of fact, was donating his prize fighting money to the U.S. government. That was what his issue was about as far as the money was concerned, and they still went about the means of destroying him, literally to where his way to make money was to accept donations for the rest of his life, because he was permanently damaged by that. I thought it was interesting that didn't happen to Mr. Robeson. And those are some of my observations, and thanks everybody for listening.
Much obliged. Retired firefighter, Robin, Wisconsin, or other folks who are with us.
Yes, sir.
Proceed.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
So I have a question. Was Paul Robeson, sentenced to greater confinement in the state of New York?
Let's see. I don't recall them talking about him being confined for anything, at least not in recollection. My memory might be bad, but I don't remember him being confined.
I don't either.
Yeah, I don't remember that. You said in New York. Do you remember him being in greater confinement in New York for some reason?
So I thought I heard that he was in prison for a small amount of time. Am I incorrect on that?
I don't remember that at all. I remember him, you know, having different difficulties and that sort of thing. But yeah, I don't remember him being in prison in New York at all.
Okay, then I'll move on from that statement. So what stood out to me in that segment was the contract between the so-called America and Japan, and where it was basically like a conflict between America and Japan. That really stood out to me. And I'll table the rest of my comments until I hear more from either you and or a retired firefighter, because I'm a little thrown off, because I was under the impression that he was in prison in the state of New York. So I'm a little thrown off.
Was this like at what part of his life? Because he does so much traveling around. He's been here, there, then he's back
right,
stuck.
So,
yeah, go ahead.
Right, and so I thought that I heard that when maybe so maybe I'm confusing that was his travel restricted?
Yes.
Like his passport and him able to travel and that. So maybe that's where I got confused, where I thought that he was imprisoned and put in greater confinement by him being restricted, by his travel being restricted. And so my connection to that is that being under the system of white supremacy, where I owe for child support, I am unable to obtain a passport. Like, I am confined within the United States until I take care of that outstanding bill. And that's the connection that I had with that, and I confused it for Paul Robertson being sentenced to greater confinement.
Gotcha. Okay. Yeah, that I was saying that I think that's why I was saying the logic of greater confinement, because he was not convicted of a crime. They were having all these congressional hearings, House Un-American activities, and, you know, you're not a patriot and that sort of thing, wag their finger. But I mean, he hadn't committed a crime. He wasn't convicted, even in these hearings. They found him in contempt, I guess, but they didn't convict him. He wasn't charged with anything. So, yeah, that's just the system of white supremacy saying, yeah, we just, you know, going to mistreat you. And we say that you're not American and, you know, fork over that passport and we'll make it so that you can't get a job and can't do this and can't do that and have people talk bad about you. And that's just that. But no, he was not convicted of a crime of any sort. Other, just that's just the system of racism, white supremacy. That's just how things operate. Although you can be criminalized, that does happen frequently, where it seems like, just based on the way that we're being mistreated, it seems like we have done something criminal. Let's see. Other folks, if you have commentary, again, do not wait till the last few minutes. Let's see. I thought it was important them calling him back repeatedly to the House Un-American activities. And even while he's having all of these continued health problems, he's in a weakened condition. They're emphasizing how stress response to white supremacy racism has continued to weaken his health and well-being. Duh. Even that is not an excuse. Senator James Eastland, come to get back up here right now. We got more questions for you, nigger. We don't care. Probably faking you're not sick. Get back up here. Let's see. Yeah, Walter White, we've heard about him so much this month that they got along before. Now they're not getting along. Walter White is now working with the president or different presidents, influencing, giving what the NAACP should or should not be doing. Let's see. I mentioned Lorraine Hansberry before, cowbell, married to a white man, and author of Raisin in the Sun, which is not one of my favorite plays, but I do think it's important in an act of black self-respect, her speaking up on behalf of Mr. Robeson when it was not advantageous to do so, when it could have been costly for her. Let's see. Let's see. When they talk, oh, I thought I forgot before when they mentioned W.E.B. Du Bois, just the fact that he was close to Dr. Robeson. He was present when Mr. Robeson gave one of his speeches in another country, no less. I believe they said France. And as a result of that, he was asked not to speak. Dr. Dubois. I said, now, wow. Now, that is the power of white people, where they are so ferociously attacking this one black person, just you having contact with this black person, that we're mistreating you, which they've done before. That's happened to other black people as well. Let's see. Asada Shakur, if I could think of one person. I read the article from the New York Times, so they got front page. They got him at the House on Un-American Activities, and he comes back on page 161. And he talks about how they can sharply erase. I'll just read what it says. The New York Times, his coverage in papers like the New York Times declined during the 1950 to 58 era, the period when he was under de facto house arrest, even though he wasn't convicted of anything. What was also striking was the contention of Paul Robeson Jr. that most newsreel and film footage of his father had vanished, and that most of the newsreel footage which is available had the soundtrack erased from it. Now, that's interesting to note, regardless if that is the case, because you're talking about someone who was so prominent, was giving radio interviews and singing on the phone and written interviews, and he's written an autobiography and all of this. Why would that be, where you don't have somebody who's going and having transcribed exchanges in Congress, where you got it to the exact minute when he was present and what all was said and banging on the table and all of that, and wow, the audio is scrubbed or vanishes altogether. Or we can totally blank out coverage. System of white supremacy, right? We could, a lot of different ways we can do it. We can give you coverage and have you there and have you portrayed like a fool, criminal. Even the language, I think, was some of the confusion that Rob now in San Diego was saying about him thinking that Mr. Robeson was in prison. The language I just read from that paragraph, he was on house arrest, de facto house arrest. That's the language of a criminal. That's the way that we're talking about him. That's the language that's being used. He wasn't convicted of anything, but he's on house arrest. That frequently happens in the system of white supremacy, where just the language that's used to describe black people is the language of a convict. It's the language of a slave. Let's see. Them talking about Little Rock and Paul Robeson worldwide, people in South Africa. That was such a huge case at the time period that Mr. Fuller, he said he was in Korea. He said he was talking about Little Rock. Same thing. That's how he came up with codification. We spent all that time on Little Rock. We read Melba Petilla Beale's biography as well as Elizabeth and Hazel while back. Signature work. Let's see. Daisy Bates, she was right in the center of all of that, and she's having course. I have to go back and look to see if Mr. Robeson's name came up in talking or trying to send some words of encouragement down to the folks in Arkansas. Ultra-right is mentioned again with the death or murder and castration of Emmett Till, that it's not just white people being white, it's ultra-right. Important again, the power of racism, white supremacy. Ralph Bunche, who won a Nobel Peace Prize, unless I'm misinformed, now safely ensconced in the highest reaches of the United Nations and distancing himself furiously from his former left-wing background, found it possible to contact the Robesons after years of hiatus. This is about his book. But see, distancing, they can get it so that I don't want to have too much contact. Make sure we don't have any, you know, pictures, anything. Looks like we're friends. I don't hang out with them too tough. Let's see. Oh, I thought the churches, I thought that was so great. There's so many times I wanted to make sure I get that in. On 163, there's so many times where the church is just pummeled and people have nothing quality to say about black churches. for this one, where that is one of the, at a time where Mr. Robeson did not have many venues to be able to speak and to get an outlet to kind of get his voice out about what he thought about what was happening to him, where churches offered a venue where he could speak and he could make a little bit of money. I'm sure it was great for the churches. I don't count this as a blow against the system or anything. I mean, if they were making like millions of dollars every time out, or, you know, $100,000 every time out, oh, wow, like that's a melee. Like, that would be a little different. But I mean, doesn't sound like, I didn't hear that from what they reported. I did think it was important. it says he was spending more time on the West Coast. Let's see. Writing from their now permanent address at Harlem's Jamel Terrace, Ms. Robeson observed that her spouse spends much of his time on the West Coast, where the political and artistic climate is far superior to that of the East. The FBI, too, had noticed this trend. Love the short sentence. Bam. That's why I just keep saying that. I mean, the just everything, when you can have paid, highly trained, highly motivated staff where their job can be in like a team of people, where their entire job, what they devote maybe months, might be years of their, oh, wait a minute, let me pause right there before I get to years of their lives. One thing I did do as I was going through the footnotes, because Dr. Gerald Horn, he does quote a lot of sources from FBI files for some of the things that he quotes, what he shares in the book. One of those FBI files mentions William Sullivan's name. We did our program earlier this year. We had a white man on from North Carolina. We were talking about COINTELPRO, J. Edgar Hoover, their campaign against black people, and Dr. King specifically. He mentioned William Sullivan and talked about his dislike of Dr. King, lies that were used to discredit Dr. King and black people during the 60s and 70s and 50s in general, all the time, really. and I mentioned they had a House Select Committee on assassinations in the 1970s. Different type of Senate hearing about all of these strange killings, murders, public killings, assassinations, Dr. King, President Kennedy, so on and so forth. William Sullivan, who was the number three person at the FBI during the time of the COINTELPRO operations against Paul Robeson, Dr. King, Minister Malcolm X, Assata Shakur, blah, 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 blah. List would just go on and on and on. Muhammad Ali. William Sullivan was going to testify, and then he ends up being killed in a hunting accident shortly before he's going to testify. A hunter mistook him for a deer. This is in the New York Times. He's right in one of the footnotes from the files. I said, oh, man, I know that name. You know about COINTELPRO, you know, some of these people, you recognize that name. Like, so I said, same people, they got lots of practice harming black people, especially black people that are trying to speak out and address the problem of white supremacy, racism. But boop, so that, but to have a whole team of people like that, who that's been their job for years, some of them for 20, 30 years, this has been my career. I study the Negro. Uppity niggers who, you know, trying to do something. That's what I do. We study them, figure out how to neutralize them, study their tendencies, their habits, their strengths, their weaknesses. What's their sleep schedule? What's their travel schedule? Who are their friends? What's their eating habits? It's difficult to comprehend when you have those type of resources at your leisure, when you can have a whole staff of people that's what they do. Anything else I want to make sure? Like I said, they got the exact times of when he goes to the State Department to give these speeches, even why they would deem it necessary to talk to you. Most of the time they say that black people are the most ignorant people ever, that they want to talk to you repeatedly. Let's see. Getting support from India, again, global problem. And again, that's probably why there was such vicious, intense pressure on Mr. Robeson, him connecting white supremacy racism as a global problem. He's not just talking about Little Rock. He's talking about this South Africa, what's happening there. He's already talking about Nelson Mandela. This is born in Nkuntwe Sizwe. And he's got other non-white people, China, India, people on the continent. He knows Jomo Kenyatta already, talking about him and what's happening with black people in the States. So, I mean, I can understand why he would be public enemy number one. The importance of black journalists, just make sure I echo that again. They mentioned some of the Baltimore Afro-American, the Pittsburgh Courier, so many different papers have been mentioned throughout as we have been Chicago Defender, as we've been reading. Anything else I want to make sure I get in? Oh, yep, that's it, Chapter 8. They mentioned Ozzie Davis again. Some black self-respect. Lorraine Hansberry, Ozzie Davis, Sidney Poitier, Harry Belafonte. There's quite a few folks, quite a few black people. Ooh, that's a lot of cowbells. But quite a few black people who did speak out to support Mr. Robeson under difficult circumstances. Black self-respect. I'll pause there. Any other folks' comments they want to make sure they get in before we conclude? Next week will be our finale with this biography.
Yes, can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I think from my readings that the strategy at that particular point in time was for the racists to get at the quote unquote radical white people, who some of these people were serving as defense attorneys for some of the major cases involving non-white black victims of racist white supremacy, and in turn they also would get a lot of non-white black people. A lot of them were actors. And basically what they would do, I think the charges would be something like sedition or espionage would be kind of like difficult with the black person. It'd be more so with that particular white person. Matter of fact, I think there was a white couple that was actually convicted and put to death for espionage, but primarily with the black people, like Mr. Robeson, it would basically, quote unquote, ruin their reputation, and it'd be difficult, if not impossible, for them to have gainful employment anymore. A lot of those black actors were out of the New York area. They may not have been from New York, but they were in the New York area. I can recall at one time that even Mr. Belafonte, they was really after him at one point in time, before he became one of the top actors in this part of the world. Also, one thing I observed from the reading was the strategy of the racists. I would say it'd probably be something similar to the cliche, divide and conquer. They basically enacted the 1954 Supreme Court decision in order to invest into some a segment of non-white black people. I keep hearing the term that I don't really use it, the term middle class, to create a middle class. Therefore, someone like a Mr. Robeson, that particular non-white black person, probably wouldn't be that much attentive of what he has to say and ideas, because by doing so, it would threaten the investment that you have received from the racist by getting a job as a teacher or something somewhere in the government, something like that, you know, that sort of thing, which is, you know, quite devious of white people, but that's what they do. And those are my thoughts that I got from the second half of the reading. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. We are pretty much at the end of the broadcast. We will wrap things up next week. All done. Wowee. And then we'll be pushing off to a new book in 2 weeks. But it has been a hoot learning about, well, I won't say a hoot. It's mostly been kind of depressing, but important. Just seeing how white people can neutralize resources against an individual victim of racism, white supremacy, if they think they're effective or might be stumbling close to being accurate, might cause us some problems. Seeing how they Voltron and work together globally to keep tabs on you and neutralize your effectiveness. But important to, you know what we are up against. What is racism, white supremacy, how it works. With that, we'll be here tomorrow neutralizing workplace racism. If you got time off from the plantation, then I hope you are rested, working on your code, doing some reading, getting constructive rest, eating correctly, and prepping for a new week. We will be here tomorrow, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We should be here Saturday for the compensatory call-in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. And on Sunday, Azur Savage, victim of white supremacy, should be visiting 5:30 p.m. Sunday afternoon. I have to teach yoga, so I need an extra 30 minutes to get myself together. But 5:30 p.m. Pacific, 8:30 p.m. Eastern, Sunday evening, we should be ready to roll. Azur Savage, looking forward to having him on the program, discuss his book, You Failed Us, White Supremacy in the Seattle Public Schools. With that, much obliged for folks tuning in. We will be here in about 24 hours. Sobriety would be best, especially this weekend. Sobriety checkpoints will be out. I'm sure enforcement officers are going to be looking to get a few of those holiday tickets in. Stay sober. You got to consume anything, get to one spot and stay there. You do not want to be out and about on this here weekend. In addition to being sober, make sure you are buckled every time you are in a vehicle, passenger or driver. Let's do everything we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. In addition to being sober and buckled, if you are driving, you are not on the cell phone. Again, just trying to do the little things to stay as safe as we can under conditions of terrorism. With that, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.